Daniel Zeichner, MP. That's all from us. I'm Anna Hill. The producer was Rebecca Rooney. Farming Today is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
This is BBC Radio 4 on 92 to 95 FM on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 11th of November. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. The headlines today. The BBC is facing a $1 billion lawsuit from President Trump over last year's misleading Panorama edit as MPs prepare to discuss the crisis in Parliament. How serious is this legal threat? We're going to be hearing from a Trump confidant, the boss of the US network Newsmax. New analysis by the BBC has found that only three of England's 121 NHS trusts are meeting targets for treating cancer patients quickly enough. And the US Senate has passed a bill aimed at ending the longest government shutdown in US history after a group of Democrats broke ranks.
Also in today's programme, the Booker Prize winner David Soloy, whose novel Flesh explores the three stages of modern man, will join us live in the Today studio. And
I want to be 14 again, tattoo myself with a fountain pen, pretend to like the taste of rum and coke.
Always brilliant Victoria Wood, a new musical called 14 Again, and a theatre in the Lake District are being named after her to celebrate the comedian. We will speak to those behind the project. Before all of that, though, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Tom Sanders.
Lawyers acting for President Trump have given the BBC until Friday evening to respond to his threat of a $1 billion lawsuit over the way one of his speeches was edited in an episode of Panorama. The BBC has said it will reply in due course to Mr. Trump's demand for a full and fair retraction of the documentary, which has sparked a major row about impartiality at the corporation. The BBC's Director General and Head of News both resigned on Sunday, and today MPs are expected to discuss the issue when they return to Westminster, as our political correspondent Ben Wright explains.
A debate in the Commons on the turmoil at the BBC is likely, with the government expected to repeat Downing Street's view. The Number 10 does not believe the corporation is institutionally biased, but wants to see mistakes corrected quickly. The Conservatives and Reform UK have been far more critical of the BBC's internal culture. Yesterday, the BBC's chairman, Samir Shah, strongly rejected claims of systemic bias and dismissed allegations that members of the corporation's board had orchestrated a politically motivated coup as a fanciful notion. But both the Liberal Democrats and the SNP are calling for the removal of one of the BBC's board members, Sir Robbie Gibb. A former senior editor at the BBC who was director of communications for Theresa May in Downing Street. The Lib Dem leader Sir Ed Davey said to ensure the BBC's independence and impartiality, Sir Robbie should have no role in appointing the new Director General. Sir Robbie hasn't responded to all this yet. The Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch said the focus should be on the mistakes made rather than chasing people because of their political opinions.
Analysis by the BBC has revealed that just three NHS hospital trusts out of 121 in England are meeting health service targets for treating cancer patients quickly enough. Treatment is meant to begin within 62 days of an urgent referral. The government is set to publish a new cancer strategy early next year, but the Nuffield Trust think tank says that it'll be increasingly challenging to make meaningful progress on waiting times. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
Targets require NHS trusts in England to diagnose patients within 28 days of a referral, leaving them waiting no more than a month before treatment, with a total wait time of 62 days. BBC analysis of trusts between September 2024 and August this year found only a handful hit all three targets, and nearly a quarter missed all of them. Experts say timely treatment can improve survival rates. The government is to publish a cancer strategy for England next year and says cancer care is a priority after the NHS had faced a decade of neglect.
Health leaders are warning that a strike by resident doctors in England due to start on Friday could wipe out a once-in-a-generation chance to fix the health service. NHS Providers, which represents trusts, says the action could crush what it called the fragile, hard-won progress of recent months. Resident doctors are set to walk out for 5 days as part of a long-running pay dispute. Their union, the British Medical Association, says the government can stop the strike by making doctors a decent offer. Ministers have insisted they will not negotiate on pay. The US Senate has agreed a compromise funding package to end the longest federal government shutdown in American history. 8 Democrats voted with Republicans to back the deal, sparking a bitter backlash within their party. Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
The Senate vote, coming on the 41st day of the government shutdown, is a major step towards ending a political impasse that has led to cutbacks in federal food aid programs, flight delays, and more than a million employees working without pay. Democrats had been demanding an extension of healthcare subsidies, but in the end, Republicans' resistance to that won out. The capitulation of 8 Democratic senators has infuriated many of their colleagues, who labelled the move a betrayal.
Indian capital Delhi has been put on high alert following a huge blast in a car near the historic Red Fort. At least 8 people were killed and 20 others were injured in the explosion, which happened on a crowded road yesterday. Police say the investigation is progressing quickly. Security has been stepped up at sensitive public sites, including the Taj Mahal. More than 900 people have been arrested in a crackdown on illegal high street businesses. Takeaways, barbers and car washers were among those raided in an operation led by the National Crime Agency, as our UK editor Ed Thomas reports.
The National Crime Agency worked with every UK police force, trading standards and immigration enforcement to target more than 2,500 shop fronts, including mini-marts, vape shops and car washes. Illegal tobacco, vapes and cannabis worth millions of pounds were seized in the operation. There were also more than 340 referrals for illegal working and renting. Last week, a BBC investigation exposed a Kurdish high street crime group enabling illegal working. The NCA said the threats from organised high street criminality needed a national approach.
This year's Booker Prize has been awarded to the British-Hungarian author David Szolai for his novel Flesh. The book tells the story of a man who moves from a Hungarian housing estate to the world of London's ultra-rich. Charlotte Gallagher was at last night's awards ceremony.
The winner of the 2025 Booker Prize is Flesh.
David Szolai was visibly stunned to win one of the most prestigious prizes in literature.
Yeah, wow.
Flesh tells the story of a man who moves from a Hungarian housing estate and becomes part of London's wealthy elite. The judges, who included the actress Sarah Jessica Parker and the Irish author Roddy Doyle, discussed the 6 shortlisted novels for more than 5 hours before awarding David Szolai the prize, which comes with a £50,000 cheque.
Charlotte Gallagher reporting.
You, Tom. 6:07 now. Let's check the weather here, Simon King. Morning.
Good morning, Anna. Yeah, it's pretty wet out there for some of us this morning, and the rain today could cause some issues with some localised flooding. Let's get right into it for southwest England and Wales, where heavy rain this morning has started to clear away to the north. Lots of cloud around, though. Still could see a few showers throughout the morning, and then that's all before the next bout of heavy rain spreads in from the west during this afternoon. But it could lead to some localised flooding in parts of south Wales and southwest England. A lot of rainfall expected here. Maximum temperatures 12 to 15 degrees with a brisk southwesterly wind. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, it's pretty damp at the moment across the Midlands with some light rain, but cloudy and dry elsewhere. A few bright spells may well develop. It will be a little bit breezy and temperatures are 14 or 15 degrees. Across northern England, rain is currently moving in from the southwest. It will turn quite heavy for a time, moving quite quickly northward, clearing during the afternoon. A few bright spells in northeast England, 12 to 15 degrees, the temperatures here. Now, it's for Northern Ireland and across central and southern Scotland, where rain already quite heavy in Northern Ireland. Rain spreads into southern Scotland, pushing northward, where it's going to be quite persistent, really, for much of the late morning into the afternoon. Could bring some localised flooding, particularly Northern Ireland, southwest Scotland, with some heavier rain, temperatures of 10 to 14 degrees. But across northern Scotland, some clear spells this morning. Plenty of sunshine, actually, for most of the day, only the rain arriving here in by this evening, with highs of 9 to 11 Celsius.
Thank you very much indeed, Simon. It is now 6:09. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. President Trump's threat of legal action against the BBC features on most of the front pages, including The Sun, which describes Panorama's edit of his speech as the Beeb's billion-dollar bungle. Trump tells BBC, grovel or I'll sue, says the Mail's headline. The Telegraph says the extraordinary move by the US president has turned the screw on a corporation that's reeling from the resignations of the Director General and the head of news, whilst the iPaper says the future of the licence fee is now in jeopardy, with the BBC left weakened ahead of negotiations with the government.
The Guardian claims a BBC board member with links to the Conservatives led the charge in pressuring the corporation's leadership over claims of systemic bias before Tim Davie and Deborah Turness announced that they were stepping down. Sources have told the paper that Theresa May's former Director of Communications, Sir Robbie Gibb, amplified the criticism in key meetings. Writing in The Guardian this morning, the Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, says Sir Robbie should be removed from the BBC board before the search begins for a new Director General.
Comments to the BBC by the Chancellor signalling she could scrap the two-child benefit cap are highlighted by The Times. It says Rachel Reeves appeared confident of funding the move, thought to cost more than £3 billion, despite Treasury concerns that levies on gambling will not be enough. The Guardian says Ms Reeves is hoping that removing the cap will placate many Labour MPs who are concerned about the political consequences of raising income tax.
And the main news for the Daily Mirror this morning is a new interview by Prince William given to a TV channel in Brazil. He's there attending the COP climate summit, in which the heir to the throne revealed that he and the Princess of Wales were honest with their children about her cancer diagnosis. Hiding stuff doesn't work. We chose to communicate a lot more, he says. The paper's leader column also talks about this morning, applauding what it calls the openness of the royal couple, noting honesty is the best policy, allowing love, patience and clarity to steady even the stormiest seas.
Time now, 11 minutes past six.
The longest ever government shutdown in US history is a step closer to being resolved. David Willis is our North America correspondent. He's been telling me about the impact that this has had on daily life.
It's had an enormous impact, Anna. It's led to cutbacks in crucial food aid programs for low-income Americans, more than 40 million of whom rely on so-called food stamps. We've seen thousands of flights delayed or cancelled because air traffic controllers have not been turning up to work. More than 1,000 flights a day over the last few days have been cancelled, and more than 1 million government employees in this country have been working without pay. So now we have a solution to this impasse, it would seem, and this bill will now go to the House of Representatives, which, of course, like the Senate, is controlled by the Republicans, and we're expecting a vote to take place on Wednesday in the lower house. Tomorrow is a national holiday here, whereupon the bill goes to the desk of the president, and Mr. Trump has indicated he's very keen to sign it into law, and that will pave the way for the federal government to finally reopen by next weekend.
So as you say, David, there is a solution on the cards now, but it hasn't been without fallout.
It hasn't. Democrats have been holding out, Anna, for an extension of health care subsidies for low-income Americans. Those subsidies are due to come to an end at the end of this year. Republicans insisted they weren't going to engage on the issue until the shutdown was over. And it appears they've won. I mean, all the Democrats have ended up with, it seems, is a commitment from the Senate Majority Leader to hold a vote on extending health care subsidies by mid-December. That's infuriated members of the Democratic Party who were not among the eight who voted with the Republicans. They've accused those eight of betrayal, of surrender, and it's prompted calls once again for the removal of the party's leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, for failing to keep his caucus together, even though, it's worth pointing out, Anna, he voted against the shutdown-ending deal that was agreed upon tonight.
David Willis, thank you.
It is now 13 minutes past six. Security has been tightened at the Taj Mahal and other popular tourist attractions in India after that big explosion on a crowded road near another popular tourist site, the Red Fort in Delhi. Our correspondent in Delhi is Davina Gupta. Davina, what more can you tell us about what the police think happened here?
Well, Nick, for now, they're still trying to connect the dots. The site of the explosion near Delhi's Red Fort remains sealed. Barricades have been put around the place. I was there last evening and I could see there were remnants of cars and motor-driven rickshaws that were reduced to charred husks. And eyewitnesses there were talking about hearing a loud sound, seeing smoke and fire at the scene. And the police for now has confirmed that the explosion happened when a slow-moving car stopped at a traffic signal before it exploded. But we are yet to find what's the cause behind it. Investigators have been using sniffer dogs, scanning CCTV footage and combing through the debris overnight. For now, no shrapnel has been found, and that's been confirmed by Delhi police. But they've also registered a case under the country's main anti-terror law, which is the UAPA. And they say they're exploring all angles at the moment.
Davina Gupta in Delhi. Thank you.
It is just coming around to 6:15. We were talking about the government shutdown in the US nearing an end, and the FTSE 100 share index has hit another record high after stock prices around the world rose on those hopes. Sean Farrington's here with more on that and the rest of the day's business news. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Anna. Yeah, FTSE 100, what, more than a percent yesterday, passing 9,800 for the first time. Similar gains on mainland Europe, across the US as well. Russ Mould, Investment Director at AJ Bell. Morning, Russ. Good morning to you. What has actually driven these record highs? Is it all about the US shutdown?
Good morning to you, Sean. In the short term, I think it probably is. I mean, America is the world's largest economy. It's home to the world's largest stock market, biggest bond market, the world's reserve currency, the dollar. So the American economic engine is a very powerful one. And if it's purring away, then that in theory should help all others. So yeah, that is definitely a short-term positive. But for the UK over the longer term, well, partly it was ignored for a very long time. So it got very, very cheap. But UK multinationals are doing well on a global basis, and they have, well, even once they've invested in their core proposition and their competitive position, they have a bit of spare cash left, quite a lot of spare cash left, and they're returning that to shareholders and providing a really good yield on their shares, and that is luring a lot of investors in.
Yeah, so when we've seen that sort of wave of returns of cash to shareholders, why aren't those businesses investing more of that into their future infrastructure, their productivity, instead of giving so much back to shareholders?
If they're not doing that, they're making a massive mistake and they're cutting corners. And you have seen that with some American companies like GE or Intel, who just involved themselves more in financial engineering than product engineering, and eventually caught up with them. So if companies are doing that, they are fools unto themselves. I think one reason why companies have been reluctant to invest is interest rates being at zero, they didn't know what the real cost of capital was. And if you don't know what the cost of capital is, you don't know what your return is. So they're held back on that. And then we've got that dreadful word that we use nearly every day, uncertainty. Some firms have been holding back to wait and see, but a lot of these companies are investing. They've still got a lot of cash left, so they're either paying out dividends or buying back shares. In the UK, including takeovers, you're getting about £160 billion of cash back from UK stocks this year. That's about 6% of the stock market capitalisation.
So, yeah, so we hear some investors are reacting to how businesses, some of the biggest businesses on our stock markets, have been behaving, global businesses as well. Onto the bond market, Russ. So these investors around the world that effectively, in one way or another, set an interest rate for the UK government, amongst others, to borrow, you know, and make a judgment on the state of the nation's finances. Rachel Reeves, our Chancellor, has been talking a lot, talking more to Matt Chorley in the last 24 hours about manifesto pledge breaking, potential increases of income tax, potential scrapping of two-child benefit tax caps. How are those investors viewing this pathway that Rachel Reeves is laying out for everybody?
She seems to be doing a pretty good job of mollifying at the moment. We were talking at the start of the year when the 10-year gilt, the interest rate the UK government pays over on its 10-year borrowings, reached nearly 5%. That's come down to 4.4, 4.5%. So I think she's at the moment managing to tread the right balance between obviously keeping fractious backbenchers happy, kind of look after consumers, and keeping those bond vigilantes happy as well.
At the same time, then you've got the household aspect of this, how are shoppers viewing what might be on the horizon with the budget? Some interesting data out this morning from the British Retail Consortium. They see that seen some of the slowest sales growth for a good few months. Barclays and their Barclaycard customers, they say that a third of shoppers are holding off on big purchases, waiting till after the budget. Are you starting to see it filter through into hitting the economy at all?
I think people will be waiting to see what's coming out in late November, but there are other factors there as well. Some people may be waiting for the Singles Day and Black Friday deal deals. My email inbox is absolutely swamped with the things at the moment. But also unemployment has been ticking up and job vacancies have been declining. We're getting some numbers on those at 7 o'clock this morning. So that will be possibly focusing a few minds as well, quite understandably. Though if you are in employment and you're getting the sort of average 5% wage growth right now, you are beating inflation, so you're able to maintain your standard of living. Touch wood, that is a positive thing at least.
Singles Day, Russ.
Yeah, it's the big Chinese holidays now. I think I've got all sorts of stuff in my email inbox at the moment.
Interesting. So coming through in for the British shopper as
there
well.
There is no escape, Sean, I can assure you.
No, very interested. Russ, gold price as well, just amidst everything. A lot of things rising in price yesterday. And gold making a move too.
Yeah, it's had a fantastic run. It reached a new all-time high earlier on in October, actually, of nearly $4,400 an ounce. Had a bit of a pullback. Now it's on the march again, possibly because of part of the way in which President Trump is trying to resolve this impasse in the US. He's also talking about a $2,000 tax break or payment direct to consumers, funded, he claims, by tariffs. And that sort of monetary handout potentially running the American economy hot again. Lower taxes, lower dollar, lower oil, lower interest rates. But that also could mean inflation. And some investors do view gold as a bit of a haven, as it were, and a safe haven against the ravages of inflation.
Interesting. Russ, thank you very much. Russ Mould, Investment Director at AJ Bell. Let's bring in Zoe Lyons on the gold topic. Managing Director at Hatton Garden Metals, family-run gold dealership based in London's jewellery district. Zoe, morning to you. How have these... The recent particular volatility in the gold price, we had that big, long, massive increase in price up by over 55%, then a bit of a almost 10% hit, now up again. Are you finding customers are starting to almost trade this movement that we're seeing?
Hi, morning. Yeah, I think absolutely. I think you touched on some really interesting topics before as well. And I think most overwhelmingly at the moment, we're just in very exciting times. As we've touched on, gold is back on the march again. It's been hitting headlines everywhere. I think we've broken records more times this year than ever before, all about the price being so high.
But why are people buying it? Because actually, if you could have said that a few weeks ago and somebody might have bought some gold then and actually lost 10% of their investment.
Because we're seeing this volatility. So yeah, the gold price is very, very high. And I think what that means for the sort of average UK, you know, person on the street is they are realising now more than ever that people are able to cash in quite quickly on items that maybe typically they hadn't necessarily seen as gold. So we're seeing more watches come through just for their gold content. And people are realising so much how they can get involved in this market. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the volatility, someone buying 2 weeks ago to where it was, where we had a little bit of a bounce back, potentially would. Gold is seen as a safe haven investment. So many people look at gold as a longer term investment.
Has that changed a bit, do you think, in the last year?
I think it's really interesting because what we've seen is people that have maybe bought gold less than 12 months ago are realising quite big profits in a relatively short period of time, which isn't necessarily one of the reasons people kind of tend to go into gold in the first place. So we're seeing a much wider spectrum of investors coming to the market. That includes younger people, that includes people coming with slightly smaller volumes because they don't want to miss out. They don't want to, there's a FOMO about the gold market. They're seeing it everywhere. They're seeing it all over the news and people want to know how they can get involved in that.
And we know that talking about FOMO in association with investors is never the safest way of approaching things. Zoe, thank you so much. Zoe Lyons, Managing Director at Hatton Garden Metals there. Now, Diageo mentioned yesterday that they'd appointed a new boss, the former boss of Tesco, Sir Dave Lewis. Well, then the trading day that followed after that, investors seemed quite happy with that appointment. Shares up almost 6% in the huge manufacturing giant for drinks, Johnny Walker Whiskey, Smirnoff Vodka, Captain Morgan Rum, of course, Guinness as well. So what is the job that Dave Lewis has at hand? Trevor Sterling is beverages analyst at Bernstein. Trevor, morning. What's he got to do, Sir Dave Lewis, now he's in charge there?
Well, I think there's probably three things, two of which are underway, but one of which I think is probably the biggest challenge. So the two that are underway is a renewed focus on margins, and that's definitely the current interim CEO, who came in as CFO a year or so ago, has started that process, so that probably needs to be accelerated. The second thing is just pay down the debt. The level of debt they're running at is much more than they would like, ideally, so there's focus on cash flow and paying down debt. But I think the third thing, and the hardest one, is turning around the top line. Diageo is a company that used to grow at 4, 5, 6% per annum, and last reporting period was down 1%. So it's really about the top line turnaround for me.
And how will this filter through into the supermarket shelves, the bars right around the world? Do you think some of these famous brands that it has are going to have to really change their approach?
I think in some cases, yes. But I think it's also about new opportunities. So for example, Diageo's had huge success with tequila in the United States with two brands called Casamigos and Don Julio. But they're relatively expensive. They're priced at around $50 a bottle. And where the sweet spot is at the moment is around $30 a bottle. So a lot of it's going to be re-emphasizing brands, probably de-emphasizing some of the flavors that they've been launching over the last few years and finding the mojo again.
And so does that mean price reductions that people are going to be seeing?
Probably not significant. I mean, a little bit of tactical reductions here, there. But if you've got a brand that's $50 a bottle and you try to reduce it down to 30, you'll destroy what they call the brand equity. So your image and the consumers will be destroyed and you'll destroy your margins. So it's not as easy as just slashing prices. It's much more about turning around consumer perceptions of the brands. And that takes time.
And is there something that you saw him do at Tesco that you think really needs to be done at Diageo now?
Well, I think he clearly managed a superb turnaround at Tesco, but it's more his experience at Unilever, where he ran many geographies. He was marketing director in South America. He ran Indonesia. He ran the UK. He ran the US. And he was instrumental in the development of the Dove brand. I think that's going to be more directly relevant, or even more directly relevant, if you like, than his Tesco experience.
You know, almost a word, Trevor, spin-off of Guinness?
Unlikely. It's the fastest growing bit of the business. Why would you sell off your crown jewel unless you're really pushed?
Thank you. Trevor Sterling there, beverages analyst at Bernstein.
Thank you very much indeed, Sean. It is 25 past six now. Time for the sport. Natalie Perks is here. Morning.
Morning. Chelsea boss Sonia Bampasta says goalkeeper Hannah Hampton hasn't travelled for their Women's Champions League match against St. Pölten in Austria tonight after picking up an injury against Arsenal at the weekend. But Lauren James is in contention to make her first appearance for Chelsea this season. Meanwhile, Blues midfielder Kira Walsh has responded to the news that Arsenal defender Katie Reid has suffered an anterior cruciate ligament injury in training and will miss the rest of the season. Reid is the latest in a long line of women since the start of this campaign in September to damage their ACL.
I think the governing bodies need to listen to the players. I think maybe sometimes we do play too many games in the congested fixtures. There's not enough time. I think we're the ones ultimately who are going through it. So, like, yeah, you can do the research, but ultimately you need to listen to the ones who are going through it and, yeah, how we can best find solutions for that going forward.
In tennis, the big talking point is whether Jannik Sinner or Carlos Alcaraz will end the year as world number one. Second seed Sinner began his ATP finals title defence with a win against a physically hampered Felix Auger-Aliassime at the last tournament of the season in Turin.
He's one of the toughest players to beat. I know 6-5 SI, he struggled physically, and you know, you don't want to win obviously in this way, but you know, in the other way you take it. We only wish him a speedy recovery. Hopefully he gets back 100%. We need him in this competition. You know, he's one of the top 8 players.
And former world number 2 Ange Jabeur will be delaying her return to the court as she's announced she's having her first baby. The 3-time Grand Slam finalist has been on a break from the tour since her first round exit from Wimbledon in July. In rugby union, England have injury concerns over back Tommy Freeman and second row Ollie Chesham ahead of their autumn international against New Zealand on Saturday. Both missed training yesterday with injuries. England flanker Sam Underhill is ready for a tough test against the All Blacks.
It's exciting to play against good players, especially Ardie Savea's been consistently one of the best back rows in the world for a number of years now. So playing against guys like him is brilliant. Same goes for Wallace Asiti. He's a very, very good player. Playing for England especially, you want to be playing against the best and you want to be challenging yourself. And there's no better challenge than a team like the All Blacks and the talent that they have and the ability they have.
And Amila Aswat has made history at Kempton, becoming the first black British female jump jockey to ride in Britain. The 20-year-old finished 5th of 10 aboard the Kim Bailey and Matt Nichols trained Guchen in the handicap hurdle.
Thank you very much indeed, Natalie. Returning this weekend to Radio 4, the panel show that gives us new perspectives on our food, cooking and culinary habits.
Single cream, salad dressing, whipping cream, piping stuff.
Whether you've got a burning cookery question or simply wondering what to do with that mystery ingredient.
Seaweed with fish is kind of like as they were in life together. In death, they go really well together as well.
Jay Rayner and his panel of food enthusiasts travel the UK to serve up their culinary wisdom with some local flavour.
Get in, you can tell you come from the northeast.
The Kitchen Cabinet with Jay Rayner.
Right, well, this theme's going brilliantly.
returns on Saturday morning at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It is just coming around to 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. And now a summary of the news with Tom Sanders.
The BBC has been given until Friday to respond to President Trump's threat of a $1 billion lawsuit over the way that one of his speeches was edited in a Panorama documentary. The BBC has said that it will reply in due course to Mr. Trump's demand for a full and fair retraction of the programme, which has sparked a major row about impartiality at the corporation. The BBC's Director General and Head of News both resigned on Sunday. MPs are expected to raise questions on the issue in the Commons today. Analysis by the BBC has found that just three out of the 121 NHS hospital trusts in England are meeting targets to treat cancer patients within 62 days of an urgent referral. Experts say timely treatment can improve survival rates. A government spokesperson said cancer care was a priority. United States senators have passed a budget measure to end the longest-running government shutdown in American history. Eight Democrats voted with Republicans to resume funding the federal government until the end of January. The legislation will need to be approved by the House of Representatives. The government is setting out plans to reduce testing on animals, except in exceptional circumstances. New technologies mean drugs can instead be tested on lab-grown human tissue or computer chips containing small amounts of cells. But there are concerns among some scientists that the move could alienate pharmaceutical companies. The National Crime Agency has led raids on 2,500 illegal high street businesses, leading to the arrests of more than 900 people. Millions of pounds worth of illegal tobacco, vapes and cannabis was seized in the month-long operation. The British-Hungarian author David Soloy has been awarded the Booker Prize for his novel Flesh. The book, which explores themes of class and power through the life of a Hungarian man who ends up in the company of London's super rich, was described by judges as extraordinary. Tom, thank you very much indeed. It's now 29 minutes to seven. Donald Trump's lawyers are demanding $1 billion from the BBC, which the Sun helpfully points out this morning is equivalent to 4.4 million licence fees. Ouch. That is, of course, a lawsuit over the way his speech was edited in an episode of Panorama, which the BBC has now apologised for. We're joined in the Today studio by Lisa Mazimba, our entertainment correspondent. What more do we know about this lawsuit, Lisa?
Well, we know from the letter that Donald Trump's lawyers have sent to the BBC that unless a complete retraction is made and things put right by a deadline of Friday this week, they say that Donald Trump will sue the BBC for $1 billion. Now, it's over, of course, this Trump edit in Panorama. That is the thing he seems most exorcised about. As you say, the BBC have already apologised for this, so no doubt it's been scoured by BBC executives and BBC lawyers to see exactly what the situation is.
Now, someone saying they will sue, particularly if that someone is Donald Trump, is not the same as them actually suing. Someone like Donald Trump asking for $1 billion is not the same as them getting $1 billion. He's sued virtually every news organisation in the United States, hasn't he? What's the BBC now saying?
Well, the BBC is saying very little. It's saying it's looking at what Donald Trump has said to them. And I think it's not hugely likely we'll hear a huge amount from the BBC about this ongoing process over the next few days. But as you say, there is a difference between somebody saying they will sue and somebody saying they're actually suing. He hasn't reached the point where he's actually suing. What Donald Trump is saying is that if an retraction that he's happy with isn't made by the end of the week, then he will sue for $1 billion. So that will become a case in itself. So what the BBC is looking at, what Donald Trump's lawyers will be hearing, I assume, is some kind of discussion about can a settlement be reached within that deadline. I think it's unlikely we'll hear from the BBC about that exact process. But of course, if some kind of agreement is reached by Friday, I think few would be surprised if we didn't then hear from the President about what kind of settlement has been reached over this breach, which the BBC has apologised for.
Quick last one, Lisa. Who's running the place? I mean, clearly the chairman of the BBC is still here, but is the Director General still here and functioning, the head of news too?
Well, he's still here. He's actually addressing staff this morning. So this will be the first chance we'll have to actually hear from the man who right now is still running the BBC, and it's likely that he'll talk about and be asked about all these events. But he said he'll be stepping down in the future.
Lisa Mazimba, thank you for joining us.
Henry Zerfman is our chief political correspondent. Morning, Henry.
Good morning.
Highly likely that everything happening at the BBC will be discussed by MPs later. They've got a lot they want to say.
Yes, that's right. I think we expect a debate in the House of Commons in some form later today, probably in the form of an urgent question. Lisa Nandy, the Culture Secretary, would speak for the government in that, and I'd expect her to repeat Downing Street's view, expressed via a spokesman for the Prime Minister yesterday, that Number 10 doesn't believe the BBC is institutionally biased, but it does want to see any mistakes corrected quickly. Other political parties, though, in a pretty different place. I think it is really striking how far the Conservative Party's language and criticism of the BBC has shifted, way beyond any criticism they expressed when they were in government. Kemi Badenoch suggesting yesterday that the BBC may well be institutionally biased against women and against Jews. Priti Patel, her shadow foreign secretary, has said that the BBC is the Hamas broadcasting service. Then you have the Liberal Democrats, as well as the Scottish National Party, in the form of the First Minister of Scotland, John Swinney, calling for the removal of Sir Robbie Gibb from the BBC board. All of that, I'm sure, will be expressed in the House of Commons later. And just a more general point, what all parties say, think, feel about the BBC matters. Because while the government may be more phlegmatic, and while the government may well be looking ahead to the charter review process, which a consultation related to that may well be launched within weeks or even months, to state the obvious, at some point, whether it's in another decade or more, the BBC is going to have to agree its charter with a government run by another party.
Mm. And an interview on the BBC yesterday, making various of the front pages this morning. This is the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, talking to Matt Chorley on Five Live, again, hinting as to what we might see in the budget.
Yeah, in a very significant way, twice over, actually, Anna. So first, let's talk about the two-child benefit cap, which prevents parents from claiming universal credit or child tax credit for a third child or any subsequent children. It is deeply unpopular with Labour MPs, who see it as the biggest barrier to lifting hundreds of thousands of children out of poverty. Rachel Reeves said, "I don't think it's right that a child is penalised because they're in a bigger family through no fault of their own." Well, that was pretty clearly her saying to Labour MPs, look, the two-child benefit cap is going to change. There'd been some suggestion they might taper it rather than lift it altogether. But the argument that Rachel Reeves advanced is also an argument against a three-child benefit cap or a four-child benefit cap. So I think a lot of people thought that was a pretty clear and significant direction of travel. She also said, when asked the perennial question, as it now is and will be right up to the budget, about whether she's going to stick to her manifesto commitments on tax, she said it would of course be possible to stick with the manifesto commitments, but that would require things like deep cuts in capital spending. Well, just to be clear, Rachel Reeves does not want deep cuts in things like capital spending. Those around her playing down the significance of those comments, but I think it is pretty significant that she had the arguments in favour of a manifesto breach so readily accessible at the front of her mind.
Mm. Henry, thank you. Henry Zerfman there, our chief political correspondent.
It's 23 minutes to seven now. A Chinese woman at the heart of the UK's largest seizure of cryptocurrency has pleaded guilty to money laundering and is due to be sentenced. Watching this story for us is Tony Ham from the BBC's Global China Unit. Morning to you, Tony. Tell us more about Xian Jimin, who's been convicted of what, laundering around £5 billion.
Good morning. Yeah, it's an extraordinary case, one of the largest, if not the largest, money laundering cases in the UK. And the scale of that haul, £5 billion, really reflects the scale of the wrongdoing she's alleged to have committed in China between 2014 and 2017. Police and the CPS say that she led or orchestrated a huge financial scam, a Ponzi scheme, which claimed to operate a bunch of cutting-edge technological projects, including cryptocurrency mining. And in advertising those, they pulled in about 128,000 investors from all over China. So this really was an incredibly large scam.
And where will the money go to?
So that's currently being decided. Of course, it is £5 billion, a huge amount of money, as we said. And there have been reports which suggest that Rachel Reeves is interested in retaining some of it. Obviously, we know the government's trying to balance the books at the moment, and there is a commonly spoken about fiscal black hole, which is normally placed at in sort of the tens of billions of pounds. So a bit of this Bitcoin certainly wouldn't go amiss. But indeed, at the same time, though, there are thousands upon thousands of victims in China who haven't forgotten what happened when the scheme collapsed. We've spoken to several of them, and we've heard stories of people's marriages, friendships breaking up, people sinking into debt, depression. In some cases, people even losing their lives because of the shame and the kind of desperation. Some people took their own lives. In other cases, people simply didn't have the money left to pay medical bills. And so this really had a very, very profound scarring effect. A lot of people, a lot of households, and they certainly know about this case that's happening in the UK and will be looking to recover something from this money that's been seized from Tian by the British police.
Well, Tony, the whole story is on the documentary, which you can get on BBC Sounds. It's a BBC World Service documentary called The Chinese Crypto Queen, but search for the documentary on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's just coming around to 20 to 7. Some really interesting stories on the front pages this morning. The Telegraph talks about the Prevent Counter-Terror Scheme and a three-year report by the Independent Commission on Counter-Terrorism, which says that is no longer keeping the country safe. This review has found that the government programme needed a radical overhaul, having turned away 90% of people who were referred since 2015 because they had no obvious ideology. Also, the Financial Times this morning says that Lloyds Banking Group used data from its staff's personal bank accounts in pay talks with unions. Apparently, it analysed this data from the personal bank accounts of more than 30,000 employees to assess their financial resilience. As part of the pay negotiations, it compared them with those of customers and presented them in salary talks with unions, which is a fascinating story there on the FT this morning.
If it weren't for the row about the BBC with Donald Trump suing the BBC for £1 billion, I suspect that Rachel Reeves would be all over the front pages. That interview with Matt Chorley on BBC Radio 5 Live really made news because she effectively confirmed she would raise income tax, breaking Labour's manifesto pledge. And she would, as The Guardian picks up on its front page, be, in the words of the front page headline, ready to ditch two-child benefit cap. It's an interesting story. Inside the Times as well, they're talking about the politics of the budget, and there's increasing talk, we read in the iPaper yesterday, in the Times today, of a leadership challenge potentially to Keir Starmer, not next May, as has often been talked about after very difficult local elections for Labour and those elections in Wales and Scotland, but potentially after the budget. The Times analysis piece says Rayner could hold key to number 10 if Labour loses faith in Starmer, and saying that Angela Rayner could prove to be the kingmaker in choosing a successor to Keir Starmer, as MPs say, including one quoted in the piece, the budget is a real danger moment. If we're not seen to do enough on child poverty or the cost of living, it could give the soft left massive confidence to move against the Prime Minister.
The dominant story, though, is worth saying, in the newspapers this morning, is still very much what is happening at the BBC. Donald Trump's threat to launch a £1 billion lawsuit against the corporation if it doesn't apologise, retract the panorama that's at the centre of all of this, and compensate him, which suggests some sort of financial redress. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in the programme at 10 past eight. Also, in the interest of completeness, because we do like to give you a full look at the newspapers, you make one or two appearances through the newspapers this morning, Nick. There's a rather an interesting sketch.
Can you stop laughing?
I'm partly laughing because there's a sort of a photo of you, a screen grab of you in full flow in the Telegraph this morning. Tim Stanley's sketch starts with the words, I'm going to draw myself up to my full height for this one. Nick Robinson lit a cigarette, pushed back his fedora and leant into the microphone.
But it's slightly better than the column in the Daily Mail, which describes it as a semi-deranged on-air rant.
That's the one, which, by the way, the paper clearly quite liked because they have reproduced it in full on their website, should you wish to read
them. Ooh, not suggesting any sort of form of hypocrisy there, Anna, I hope. But let's read the more serious stuff as well in the papers about the BBC, because there is a lot of serious analysis and a lot of warnings to the BBC in the newspapers in its editorial. The Times says if the BBC cannot prove it can adapt and change into something leaner and fitter while still fulfilling John Reid's principles, its existence will be thrown into doubt. The FT has a similar warning for the BBC, criticises the failure of the BBC chairman to win board backing for a more timely statement of apology and defence, calls it a serious failure of leadership. The I paper has a column by Anne McElvoy, quite often heard on this network, saying the BBC deserves to survive and thrive. It's essential as a conduit to truth in a world where many bad actors want us to consume lives. But she warns that against what she calls woe is us self-regard. There are some supporters, not many has to be said, in the papers. Polly Toynbee, for example, writing in The Guardian, says the war against the BBC is a war against all of us. Let's fight back.
Henry Zeffman was telling us that MPs expected to debate the BBC in Parliament today, but yesterday in Parliament they were talking about a minister defending prison staff over the mistaken release of offenders, explaining that they have to deal with complex people in difficult situations. Our parliamentary correspondent Susan Hume reports.
It might seem extraordinary that offenders are sometimes let go when they shouldn't be, but according to the prisons minister, the process is harder than it looks.
We're often dealing with individuals with different aliases, with multiple convictions, and we need to make sure we get it right.
The prisons minister, Lord Timpson. Last Wednesday, the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, was asked repeatedly in the Commons about the issue of mistaken releases, but he made no mention that an Algerian sex offender, Brahim Kadour Sharif, and another man had been wrongly let out of Wandsworth prison last month. The news emerged just after he sat down. A Conservative, Lord Hayward, wanted to know.
When the Secretary of State was first notified of the accidental release of the said gentleman.
Lord Timpson tried to explain.
Both the Deputy Prime Minister and myself were identified first thing on Wednesday morning when we woke up. And the Deputy Prime Minister quite rightly thought it was irresponsible to potentially give incorrect information to Parliament. The information was changing rapidly, and the Deputy Prime Minister didn't want to mislead Parliament without all the details.
Sitting behind the Minister, Labour's Lady Ramsay got up with an easier question.
What, if any, impact the previous government's austerity measures and policies over a decade or more have had on the prison service today?
Lord Timpson thanked her for asking that and replied.
I've been visiting prisons and been interested in this area for 25 years, and what I've seen with the previous government is a lack of investment across the board.
And he said that was a lack of investment in prison buildings, staff and in digital technology. A Conservative and former law officer, Lord Garnier, begged him not to be so partisan. He too remembered visiting lots of jails back when he was the Shadow Prisons Minister 20 years ago.
In the 2000s, there were people escaping, there were high levels of suicide, there were high levels of violence against prison officers, there was sewage flowing from the top floors of prisons into the lower floors of prisons. Indeed, the whole estate was in a state of shambles, and the staff were in a state of low morale. So let's try and solve this problem together.
Lord Timpson said the prison service certainly needed investment to give us buildings and staff that were able to rehabilitate offenders so that they didn't come back. Labour's Lord Harris wondered how good prisons were.
In terms of the information flows that take place within prison to make sure that the officer releasing knows precisely the status of individual prisoners and indeed which prisoner they are talking to.
The minister explained that some prisons, where offenders were on shorter sentences, simply had many more people to process than others did.
The number of releases per prison varies dramatically. In HMP Gartry, they average 2 releases a year, whereas I previously said in Wandsworth it is 2,000. But that is why the digital team last week went into HMP Wandsworth to look at what are the opportunities for some quick fixes to embrace digital technology.
And maybe technology could be used to help identify the right prisoner to be released, such as
a cross-referencing for aliases, because we know some offenders have more than 20 aliases.
And he said the prison service was dealing with very complex people. So, speaking for the Conservatives, Lord Sandhurst asked about how widespread the use of pen and paper was in the release process.
How many prisons still rely on manual rather than digital release date calculations, and why that is so, and what plans there are to move to a digital system?
Lord Timpson painted a picture of a system that was very last century.
So if you were to imagine an offender management unit, there are literally boxes and boxes of paperwork all over desks and on the floor that are following offenders around the various prisons that they go to.
And he said the whole justice system needed to be linked up digitally, but hopefully with plenty of cyber security in place too.
That was Susan Hume reporting on Yesterday in Parliament. It's coming up to 11 minutes to 7.
A new analysis by the BBC has revealed the fastest and slowest NHS trust in England for cancer diagnosis and treatment. And it tells a strong story. Hugh Pym, our health editor, is here. Morning, Hugh.
Good morning, Anna.
There's a lot more slow than fast, is the top line of this.
Yes, well, the key target for cancer, the pathway for a patient, is that after an urgent referral, normally by a GP, it should be no longer than 62 days to actually start treatment. And only three trusts, according to BBC analysis, out of 121 are actually hitting that very important target, that benchmark that's been around for several years, the acknowledged standard. Now, within that, there are a couple of other targets, that the actual diagnosis should be within 28 days of an urgent referral. Then after that, a wait of no longer than 31 days, about a month, to actually start treatment. If you look at all three of them, nearly one in four trusts have been missing all three of those over the last 12 months. The 12 months up until August this year was the time that we looked at the data, the published data. So a huge variation there. The successful trusts are working very hard on the pathway, as it's called, to ensure there's no wastage of staff time or equipment time in operating theatres. They're looking at initiatives like chemotherapy at home, and it just requires relentless focus and sort of marginal gains, if you like, at all stages to deliver that improvement. Now, the government are planning a cancer strategy in England due to be published early next year. They're saying that they are working, quotes, at pace to deliver improvements in diagnosis and treatment. But there are several question marks being asked about how quickly a return to these targets can actually be made. The Nuffield Trust are saying it's going to be extremely challenging to really focus on this when there are difficulties across the piece with finances for hospitals, with so much else to focus on, including the key target for elective surgery, getting that waiting list down. So major challenges ahead on cancer care. And what the experts say is that any four-week delay can reduce survival chances by up to 10% for patients. So it's absolutely crucial that this 62-day standard is observed, and that the large majority of trusts should be doing that.
Mm. And while that is happening, in the same moment, Hugh, we have NHS providers, the membership organisation for NHS Trusts in England, warning that strikes by resident doctors planned for this week could wipe out NHS recovery, be terrible for the finances. And you were just talking about how important the finances are to try and get cancer care back on track.
Well, that's right. I mean, most trusts will say that they hope to preserve cancer care and treatment during the strike due to begin on Friday in England, but they acknowledge that that can't be absolutely taken for granted as regards elective care, planned treatment, operations, procedures and appointments. There'll be cancellations, as there were during the last strike in July, and that cost the NHS money between 250 million and 300 million because of all the cover they had to organise to make sure senior doctors, the consultants are there to cover the action by resident doctors. The government is saying it'll be the same again this time round, and that money will have to come from existing resources. There's no extra money available for that. And yeah. NHS providers' argument is there are improvements being made. Their survey shows that there are better quality of care announcements being made by chief executives, but this will be put at risk. Now, the BMA, I should say, argue that the government has not come up with enough of an offer to give them the pay rise they need over several years, and that they're having to take the strike to continue making their case.
Thank you, Hugh Pym, there, our health editor.
It is coming up to 7 minutes to seven. Now, hundreds of innocent children are being locked up each year and treated as guilty until proven innocent. That's the finding of the Children's Commissioner, who wants to see young offender units shut down. Well, she's with us. Dame Rachel D'Souza is here in the Today programme studio. Thanks very much indeed for coming in, Rachel.
Morning.
Innocent children locked up. Why is this happening?
It's crazy. So 40% of children in Young Offenders Institute are on remand. They're waiting to be sentenced. They haven't even been sentenced. They've been taken out of their education, been taken out of their normal lives and put into prison. One little boy who was found to be innocent and spent 9 months in there said, "I laid looking every night at the roof thinking, I'm innocent, but I must be guilty because I'm here." And do you know, they're using those YOIs as a waiting room. They're using them because they haven't got anywhere else for these children to go. These children are often from unstable backgrounds, can't be at home, might be a child in care. So local authorities are not stepping up to provide specialist fostering. So the judge puts them into the most violent, Feltham has just been, in 2024, the inspector told us it was the most violent prison in the country. Double the number of children than in the adult estate on remand. This is a scandal.
And you say that innocent children are likely to turn into criminals as a result of being in those sorts of
institutions. So I meet, like, not only do I do advocacy for these children, but I go in and meet them all and they tell me this is where you learn to be a criminal. Just to keep yourself safe is half of the problem.
But then the obvious question is the one you raise, in a sense, in your first answer, which is, well, where else could they go?
Yeah, and there are things that work at the moment, specialist fostering. I mean, really, we don't want to be taking a child who 20% of these children, the cases are dropped completely, 62% are found innocent. We don't want to be taking them out of education. I've got kids who are on plumbing courses, electrician courses. We need specialist foster carers. It's a cheap and effective way of dealing with this. And when it's something more serious or we're more concerned about, specialist children's homes. That's a far more humane and better place to be. So 21st century, Nick.
So there are not enough, I assume, of either of those categories. Let's start with the foster parents.
There is a massive shortage. Now, I would say the DfE minister, Josh McAllister, is working on this. He needs to rocket boost it. Come on, I think there are a huge amount of adults in this country who would step up, do the training and really support a kid in this situation. And
the Ministry of Justice, as against the department you mentioned for education, have given us a statement saying custody should be a last resort for children, reserved for those who've committed serious crimes or pose a risk to the children. And they point out we've already ended the placement of girls in young offender institutions.
So about 5% of children in YOIs were girls. It's absolutely right they're out of there. They're normally there because of serious mental health concerns. And to give successive governments their due, the numbers in YOIs have shrunk. But there are 40% of the kids going in there, of the 450, are on remand, and over two-thirds of them, the cases are dropped.
Just translate that bit of jargon that you're using there. Where-wise, did you say?
Where-wise, youth offender institutes. Look, there are 5 youth offender institutes in this country, and they are like Victorian prisons. You would be shocked. You go on the wing, and it's awful. Kids have been locked up for 22 hours a day. It's not humane. This is a democracy, a liberal democracy. We've got to do better.
We're hearing your passion. But the other thing you also mentioned that you wanted instead there were specialist children's homes.
Yes.
We then get, unlike foster care, presumably, we do get to our old friend budget, don't we? Local authorities not having the money to do that.
Whatever happens, locking a child up for their entire childhood costs a lot of money. I'd rather we did it in a humane way with secure children's homes. Some of our most serious criminals are in secure children's homes, and they are far more therapeutic and rehabilitative. Every child should have the chance for that. Even the ones who have committed serious crimes, they're going to grow into adults. We don't want them going into the adult estate or staying longer. Let's get them in secure children's homes, sort their education and sort their rehabilitation. That's what we need to do.
I'm sure they're listening. Rachel D'Souza, Children's Commissioner, thank you very much indeed for coming in.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett. For most of my career, I've been on live radio, and I love it. But I've always wondered, what if we'd had more time? How much deeper does the story go?
I remember having this very sharp thought that what you do right now, this is it. This defines your life.
I'm ready to talk and ready to listen.
I'm insulted by how little the medical community has ever bothered with this.
Ready to Talk with me, Emma Barnett, is my new podcast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Let's listen now to Simon King, who's got the weather for us.
Nick, yeah, you might not like what I'm about to say because it's pretty wet out there this morning, especially across parts of England, Northern Ireland and southern Scotland. But for Wales and southwest England, while the early morning rain that we've had has cleared away to the north, it'll stay fairly cloudy through this morning. There could still be a few showers, but it's into this afternoon that we'll see a band of heavy, perhaps thundery rain moving its way in from the west. And that could bring some localised flooding because there'll be a lot of rainfall across parts of South Wales and South West England in particular. A brisk southwesterly wind and maximum temperatures getting up to about 12 to 15 degrees. Now for the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, it's pretty damp across the Midlands with some abrupt rain this morning. That's going to clear away to the north. It'll become drier. Elsewhere, quite cloudy and dry through this morning. A few bright spells perhaps this afternoon, a little bit breezy with highs of 14 or 15 degrees. For northwest and northeast England, we've got rain that's currently moving its way into the southwest that will push northward quite quickly actually through this morning, but it will be a rather wet morning before that rain clears to the north. A few bright spells in northeast England this afternoon, 12 to 15 degrees the high. And then for Northern Ireland through central and southern Scotland, well, rain already in Northern Ireland pushing its way up into southern Scotland into late morning into the afternoon. The rain really will be very persistent throughout the day really for many of these parts. And again, there could be some localised flooding with the rain turning quite heavy, in particular for southwest Scotland and parts of Northern Ireland, temperatures of 10 to 14 degrees. But it's in northern Scotland where it's drier. There's some clear spells this morning, plenty of sunshine throughout the day. We won't see the cloud increasing with the rain moving in until later this evening with temperatures of 9 to 11 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 11th of November. The headlines this morning, MPs are expected to discuss allegations of bias at the BBC after President Trump threatened to sue the corporation for $1 billion. After the news, we'll hear what the government's response should be to the crisis at the BBC. New analysis has found that only a tiny number of England's NHS trusts are meeting targets for treating cancer patients quickly enough. And a novel about a Hungarian man who moves to London to work for the super rich has won this year's Booker Prize. We will speak to the winner, David Soloy. He'll join us here in the Today studio after eight.
Also in the next hour, could doctors' strikes this week wipe out progress being made in the NHS? We'll hear from the Doctors' Union and from the organisation that runs hospitals in the NHS in England. And what one rule would you change to improve the game of football? We'll hear from a lioness and some young experts.
Say if your foot's offside, the referee will say offside, but I think there should be freedom.
Our team didn't get a penalty when they fouled us, and then the other team, when they got fouled, they got a penalty.
More ideas about how to improve the beautiful game before 8 o'clock. First, though, the BBC News, read for us this morning by Tom Sanders.
Lawyers acting for President Trump have given the BBC until Friday evening to respond to his threat of a $1 billion lawsuit over the way one of his speeches was edited in an episode of Panorama. The BBC has said it will reply in due course to Mr. Trump's demand for a full and fair retraction of the documentary, which has sparked a major row about impartiality at the corporation. The BBC's Director General and Head of News both resigned on Sunday, and today MPs are expected to discuss the issue when they return to Westminster, as our political correspondent Ben Wright explains.
A debate in the Commons on the turmoil at the BBC is likely, with the government expected to repeat Downing Street's view. The Number 10 does not believe the corporation is institutionally biased, but wants to see mistakes corrected quickly. The Conservatives and Reform UK have been far more critical of the BBC's internal culture. Yesterday, the BBC's chairman, Samir Shah, strongly rejected claims of systemic bias and dismissed allegations that members of the corporation's board had orchestrated a politically motivated coup as a fanciful notion. But both the Liberal Democrats and the SNP are calling for the removal of one of the BBC's board members, Sir Robbie Gibb. A former senior editor at the BBC who was director of communications for Theresa May in Downing Street. The Lib Dem leader Sir Ed Davey said to ensure the BBC's independence and impartiality, Sir Robbie should have no role in appointing the new director general. Sir Robbie hasn't responded to all this yet. The Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch said the focus should be on the mistakes made rather than chasing people because of their political opinions.
Analysis by the BBC has revealed that just three NHS hospital trusts out of 121 in England are meeting health service targets for treating cancer patients quickly enough. Treatment is meant to begin within 62 days of an urgent referral. The government is set to publish a new cancer strategy early next year, but the Nuffield Trust think tank says it'll be incredibly challenging to make meaningful progress on waiting times. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
NHS trusts in England are required to hit targets for patients to be diagnosed within 28 days of a referral, then a wait of no more than a month, with a total waiting time for treatment of 62 days. BBC analysis covered performance by trusts between September 2024 and August this year, and found that while only a handful were hitting all three targets, nearly a quarter were missing all of them. Experts say timely treatment can improve survival rates. The government is due to publish a cancer strategy for England early next year, and a spokesperson said cancer care was a priority after the NHS had faced a decade of neglect. But the Nuffield Trust think tank said the reality was it would be incredibly challenging to make meaningful progress on waiting times when finances were so tight.
Health leaders are warning that a strike by resident doctors in England due to start on Friday could wipe out a once-in-a-generation chance to fix the health service. NHS Providers, which represents trusts, says the action could crush what it called the fragile, hard-won progress of recent months. Resident doctors are set to walk out for 5 days as part of a long-running pay dispute. Their union, the British Medical Association, says the government can stop the strike by making doctors a decent offer. Ministers have insisted they will not negotiate on pay. The US Senate has agreed a compromise funding package to end the longest federal government shutdown in American history. Eight Democrats voted with Republicans to back the deal, sparking a bitter backlash within their party. Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
The Senate vote, coming on the 41st day of the government shutdown, is a major step towards ending a political impasse that has led to cutbacks in federal food aid programs, flight delays, and more than a million employees working without pay. Democrats had been demanding an extension of health care subsidies that are due to expire in December, but in the end, Republicans' resistance to that won out. The capitulation of eight Democratic senators has infuriated many of their colleagues, who labelled the move a betrayal and has led to calls for the removal of the party's leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, for failing to keep his caucus together. The stopgap funding bill will now go to the House of Representatives, which, like the Senate, is controlled by Republicans. Lawmakers are expected to approve the measure later this week, paving the way for the federal government to reopen by the weekend.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has vowed to bring to justice those responsible for a car explosion in Delhi yesterday that killed at least eight people. 20 others were injured by the blast, which happened on a crowded road near the capital's historic Red Fort. From Delhi, here's Davina Gupta.
The site of the explosion near Delhi's Red Fort remains sealed this morning. Police have registered a case under the country's main anti-terror law, the UAPA, and say they're exploring all angles. Investigators have been using dogs, scanning CCTV footage and combing through the debris overnight. Security has been stepped up across the city and at several public sites in India, including the Taj Mahal, a popular tourist attraction. The Home Minister Amit Shah, who visited the scene, said a meeting involving senior officials would be held later this morning.
A Chinese woman who admitted to trying to launder cryptocurrency in the UK worth around £5 billion is due to be sentenced today. Tian Jimin took money from more than 128,000 investors in China, bought Bitcoin, and then attempted to use it to buy property in London. Investors have told the BBC they hope to get at least some of their cash back from the UK authorities. The government has set out plans to eliminate scientific experiments on animals, apart from in exceptional circumstances. The aim is to use non-animal alternatives instead. The announcement has been welcomed by the RSPCA, but it said that the government had to deliver on its promise. Here's our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh.
Animal experiments in the UK peaked at more than 4.1 million in 2015, driven mainly by increases in genetic modifications, mostly of mice and fish. By 2020, the number had fallen sharply to nearly 2.9 million as alternative methods were developed. But since then, the decline has plateaued, which the government wants to change by the greater use of alternative methods. These include testing human tissue grown in a lab, computers analysing cells, and the greater use of AI. But many scientists are sceptical that animal tests could one day reach near zero and fear that the government plan could further alienate pharmaceutical companies.
Official figures published in the past few minutes suggest average earnings grew by 4.6% in the 3 months to September. The Office for National Statistics says wage growth slowed in the private sector, but it expects to see stronger growth in the public sector, reflecting pay rises being awarded earlier than last year. This year's Booker Prize has been awarded to the British-Hungarian author David Soloy for his novel Flesh. The book tells the story of a man who moves from a Hungarian housing estate to the world of London's ultra-rich. Charlotte Gallagher was at last night's award ceremony.
The winner of the 2025 Booker Prize is Flesh.
David Soloy was visibly stunned to win one of the most prestigious prizes in literature.
Yeah, wow.
Flesh tells the story of a man who moves from a Hungarian housing estate and becomes part of London's wealthy elite. The protagonist doesn't say much, leaving readers to wonder what he thinks about the life he's created and the one he's left behind. But he's an absorbing and attractive character. The judges, who included the actress Sarah Jessica Parker and the Irish author Roddy Doyle, discussed the six shortlisted novels for more than 5 hours before awarding David Soloy the prize, which comes with a £50,000 cheque.
Charlotte Gallagher reporting.
Thank you, Tom. It's 9 minutes past seven now. MPs are expected to discuss the current crisis at the BBC in the Commons later today. The Prime Minister said yesterday that he didn't believe the organisation was corrupt or institutionally biased. Kemi Badenoch insisted there was institutional bias that can't be swept away with two resignations. Some MPs are gathering signatures for a letter in support of the corporation. What is clear is there is plenty of appetite for MPs to have their say on whether they think the BBC is or isn't doing its job properly. Well, Baroness Debonair is a Labour peer, former Shadow Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think the government should be doing at this point? And obviously it's important to say that the BBC sits apart from the government and apart from politics, but obviously holding the role it holds in this country, there is that intrinsic link. So how do you think the government should be approaching what is going on? What sort of support or otherwise should it be offering to the BBC?
I would like everyone, to be honest, everyone in government to be championing the BBC as the engine room of the creative industries, as previous ministers have said in times gone by. It's the biggest commissioner of the creative industries there is. It's a respected brand, trusted the world over because of the high quality of journalism, of research and of balance. I would like everyone to think about, be careful what you wish for. If the BBC weren't to be here, we'd want to invent it, but actually every other country in the world doesn't have the quality of public service broadcasting that we have with the BBC that we're fortunate enough to have. Does the broadcaster have things it needs to correct? Undoubtedly. And my observation is that there are methods of correction which maybe need to be looked at again. And I see that in Chair Samir Shah's letter to the Culture, Media and Sport Committee yesterday, a willingness to do that. However, I think there's also questions to be asked about how the charter renewal process, the agreement between the nation, not the state, between the nation and the BBC is done. I think the work of the British Broadcasting Challenge, a really skilled group of experts that they have done, is really helpful on this, in which they more or less say that that process of charter renewal has to be separated from political control, because what we effectively have at the moment is a rolling process, and that doesn't work for anybody. I think there are ways in which we could look again at the way board appointments are made so that there is much more clear separation between politics and the BBC. But overall, the thing I want every politician to do at the moment is ask themselves two questions. What would we do without the BBC and its ability to scrutinise, hold to account those in power? And what is it that others who wish to harm the BBC, what is it that they want? Why would they want to harm the BBC? Is it perhaps because they don't want that level of scrutiny? Is it perhaps because they'd rather there was a much more partial view of different subjects, such as climate change, to be presented? Is it because they have other interests in seeing the BBC harmed? I think the BBC is one of the most treasured aspects of our democracy. Do we need to find new ways of treasuring that? Yes. Do we need to champion it always? Absolutely yes.
How to do that then? Because the debate on this has been extensive over the last 24 hours or so and beyond. And there are many people who look at the BBC and say, when the BBC points out its importance in national life, that is the BBC not taking on board the criticism and the mistakes that have been made. So how best to balance making the change that needs to be made, say many people, while not damaging the institution at the same time?
I think several things are clearly true at the same time. And I would like all political parties to get behind, starting with championing what the BBC does. And then, yes, scrutinising, holding to account, asking questions, but above all, looking for ways in which we reduce the amount of political influence on the BBC, in which we embrace the fact that as politicians, we are rightly held to account whenever we appear on one of your outlets by the journalists of the BBC, but in which we also celebrate the fact that the BBC helps with education, with BBC Bite Size, that it creates numerous amounts of creative content, not just on the BBC, but actually in the independent production companies and on other companies. I would like everybody to celebrate the BBC and ask questions. I think both of those things can be done at the same time.
Do you think the Labour government is celebrating the BBC at the moment? It's interesting because Lisa Nandy, the culture secretary and the person who will oversee this charter renewal process, she has been deeply critical of the BBC in recent times, although it's important to note that she didn't call on Sunday morning for the resignations of either the head of news or of the director general. What do you think the Labour government should be doing right now?
Championing the BBC, asking hard questions in private, yes, scrutinising in public, yes, but also doing everything they can to separate direct political influence on the BBC over the BBC, to separate that out. But start always by championing, because in an age of mis- and disinformation, the BBC's ability to scrutinise evidence, to hold those in power to account, has never been more important.
I'm curious. You've made your point very clear about the need that you see to champion the BBC. I wonder if you think the government is doing that sufficiently at the moment.
Well, I'd like to see the government do that. And I understand that Lisa Nandy will be making a statement to the House of Commons later today. And I would say to all my colleagues who I support, start by championing the BBC, start by recognising what it does in the terms of high quality, world-beating journalism, and also its support for the creative industries and its broadcast of sport, of politics, of content for children. There's so much to celebrate. And I know I'm repeating myself, but that's because I think this needs to be said by political actors. And incidentally, I saw that yesterday in the House of Lords, that there was cross-party support, voices coming from across the House in support of the BBC. And I'd like to hope, and I believe it will happen, that that will also happen later today in the House of Commons.
Baroness Debonair, Labour peer, thank you for joining us.
It is 16 minutes past seven. The National Crime Agency has targeted 2,500 mini-marts, vape shops and car washes, arresting 900 people in a crackdown on illegal working and illegal trade in tobacco, vapes and cannabis. Following this for us is our UK editor, Ed Thomas, who had a BBC investigation last week revealing the scale of the problem in those mini markets, posed particularly by Kurdish criminal gangs. Morning to you, Ed. It's quite a big operation, this.
Yeah, this is the biggest operation of its kind. And to give you a sense of the scale of that, it involved every single police force in the UK, regional organised crime units, trading standards, immigration enforcement, HMRC inspectors. So this was a big deal. And what it speaks to is the challenge. We've done this all year, Nick, and we've seen the same story repeated from Hull to Birmingham, from Liverpool to Swansea. High streets that are absolutely covered in these mini-marts, the sale of illegal cigarettes and illegal working.
And is it a failure of local police to crack down or of council trading standards authorities? Why, as it were, does it take a national crackdown to deal with the problem?
Well, that is exactly what the NCA has said. They have said that the issues here are so big that not a single law enforcement body can solve it. This has taken hold, Nick, for years. And because we've looked at this and been all across the country on it, what you're left with is the impression that this has been a blind spot. We've all known about this in the media. Everyone can see what's happening on the high street, but we all seem to have walked on by with this, with the refrain, oh, it's just illegal cigarettes. But what we have seen is law enforcement being laughed at. We have seen trading standards officers pushed to the absolute edge. We've found underground tunnels supplying illegal cigarettes to mini-marts. I've been threatened, Nick. My BBC colleagues have been physically pushed around on the high street. We've seen stretches of road with 19 shops all selling illegal cigarettes that have been shut down in just 9 months and then reopened again. What we have heard on the ground from trading standards officers and other people is that there needs to be tougher laws to close down these shops quickly and effectively. And you do speak to MPs in some of these places, and they're saying the same things as well. We need more help to get on top of this.
Ed Thomas, our UK editor, thank you very much indeed.
18 minutes past seven. The unemployment rate has hit 5%, according to the latest official figures, which came out at seven. Sean Farrington is back with more. Hi, Sean.
Hi, yes. In the 3 months to September, that unemployment rate has jumped from the 4.8% rate that we were talking about last month. There are still some questions around the quality of the data from the Labour Force survey by the Office for National Statistics. But the ONS says the falling number of people on payrolls points towards a weakening labour market as well. Wage growth slowed in the 3 months to September. Sanjay Raja is the chief UK economist at Deutsche Bank here to help figure out what all of this means. Sanjay, an unemployment rate jumping to 5%. What does that tell us?
Good morning, Sean. The weakness in the labour market continues. And we were coming into this data point into today thinking about whether we'll start to see some of that data level off, whether the slack, to use the economist jargon, is starting to ease. And that's not the case. What we're seeing is actually more people falling into unemployment. If you look at the redundancy data, Sean, we're seeing something like 134,000 in the 3 months to September being made redundant. And that effectively pushing that unemployment rate up from 4.8% to 5%, a cyclical high. We haven't seen this level since really the onset of the pandemic. So a very unusual situation, especially given how long this has been taking. The payroll data on the HMRC side that you mentioned, down 32,000.
What's been driving this, Sanjay? Sorry to interrupt you.
No, it's a good question. And I think, A, there's a lot of government policy that I think has reduced employment. If you look at the payroll tax, for example, we know, talking to clients, we know that the Bank of England has asked this question to many businesses around the country, that this has hampered hiring plans. If you look at survey data, whether it's the KPMG REC, whether it's the DMP survey from the Bank of England, the agents from the Bank of England surveys, all kinds of business surveys telling us that businesses are stalling on employment expectations or employment because of the higher costs for payroll, national minimum wage increases that we've seen, higher inflation. There's also, by the way, Sean, a push to digitalization, automation that's also taking place, which may be muddying the waters just a little bit. So you can see retail, wholesale, hospitality potentially making that jump towards automation.
Sanjay, in terms of interest rate decision in December, how does this day-to-day impact that?
Oh, absolutely. It should help, Sean. So we've been expecting a Christmas rate cut, and I think that will happen just on the back of this data. The unemployment rate higher than what the bank expected just last week in its updated forecast. Wage growth, which I think is more important, just you know, for the point that you mentioned, Sean, yep, given the volatility and the issues around the LFS, the labor force survey, The MPC will put a lot more focus on that wage number, private sector average weekly earnings. That came down to 4.2%, very much in line.
Thank you. Sanjay Raja, sorry to cut you short. Chief UK economist at Deutsche Bank.
Thank you, Sean. 21 minutes past seven now. This week, fans, friends and family are celebrating the centenary of the birth of Richard Burton, the son of a Welsh miner who rose to become acting royalty.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black, the cobbled streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black fishing boat bobbing sea.
Richard Burton reading the opening line of Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood for the BBC back in 1954. And to mark 100 years since his birth, a blue plaque has been unveiled in his hometown and a new documentary, Richard Burton, Wild Genius, is coming out about his connection, his deep roots in Wales and also his tumultuous career. It's directed by Adrian Sibley. And I asked him what he wanted to bring out about Richard Burton in that film.
Well, I think a lot of a certain generation know about Richard Burton, but it's remarkable about my daughter, who's 18, had no idea who he was at all. You know, she thought I was talking about Tim Burton, the director of Wednesday. So for me, it was really important. And I felt that to celebrate his centenary, to get across the most remarkable story. I mean, very few actors have got a story like him. A mining background in Wales where acting was non-existent. That said, you know, he picked it up and had this remarkable rise. So I really wanted to get across the impact of how he'd come from where he did and achieved what he did.
It does make you wonder whether or not a trajectory like that would even be possible now. As you say, it was vanishingly rare then.
Well, I don't know, because Michael Sheen's an example of that. It is still possible, but it's actually focus and people like Burton are trailblazers. You know, they open a door and show what you can do if you want to. And Michael Sheen has done remarkably and has walked in his footsteps, appears in the documentary and is brilliant on Burton and the contradictions in his character, because it wasn't all plain sailing.
How do you approach a character like that and reflect all of the different facets of their personality?
I have made films about actors before, so I've worked with Tony Hopkins. I did a film for the old BBC art series Omnibus and spent time with him, and he actually came from Port Talbot as well and waited around for Burton, who arrived in a Jag, to get his autograph because he lived down the road. The contradictions within Burton are part of what makes him great in many ways. I mean, if you take a film like The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, John le Carré, novel that translated a few years after it was a bestseller into a movie with Burton, he's amazing in it because he really shows that there's something else going on inside him. You know, those contradictions are what make him fascinating. You know, once he rode to conquer Hollywood and become a very successful actor, he had to deal with the fact that he'd left behind who he was in a way, you know, his Welsh roots. And I think he was never at ease with that. You know, he was never at ease with the role of being an actor. I think he would have preferred to be a writer. He wrote some amazing diaries that were published after he passed away.
I find it sort of particularly interesting. There are some actors, you know, where they're from, their roots, it's not necessarily an important part of who they are. And we don't necessarily know that much about it. But with him, as you say, it really had an impact on everything he was and everything he did. And it's notable that you mention other Welsh actors. There are certain countries, certain parts of certain countries where that becomes such a vital part of a person's character.
Yeah, well, he's a cultural icon in Wales, and he never left Wales in some ways. You know, he enjoyed the rugby. You know, he was always the one to back the Welsh side. He was a rugby player himself. He sort of was imbued with Welshness. But at the same time, ironically, you know, his voice was English. You know, in order to succeed, he used this voice. I think there was a line of somebody saying that, you know, Richard Burton conquered the world and it wasn't even in his own language. You know, he's an Icarus figure, Burton. So brilliant. Came from Wales and suddenly was on the West End stage selling out the Old Vic as Hamlet and was remarkable. So I was fascinated with what happened to him and finding out. And it was a privilege to make a film about him.
Adrian Sibley, thank you.
We should just hear that every morning, don't you think? Slow black, crow black, fishing boat bobbing sea. But Burton does it a bit better than
me. He does it beautifully.
Does
it? Oh, so it was a valiant effort, which I appreciate, but he just edges you on that.
The focus on the word effort, though, was right. Natalie's here. Help me out, Natalie. 26 minutes past 7 here with the sport.
Morning. In tennis, second seed Jannik Sinner began his ATP finals title defence with a win against a physically hampered Felix Auger-Aliassime at the last tournament of the season in Turin last night. And Chelsea boss Sonia Bampaster says goalkeeper Hannah Hampton hasn't travelled for their Women's Champions League match against St. Pölten in Austria tonight after picking up an injury against Arsenal at the weekend. Now, Jake Whiteman has recently been named as one of the first members of Team Scotland to be officially selected for the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow next summer. He's already a two-time Commonwealth bronze medalist. This is the first time we've heard from him since he was pipped to gold by 0.02 seconds in the 1500 metres at the World Championships in Tokyo a couple of months ago. And when I caught up with him earlier, I started by asking him about the last time the Commonwealth Games were in Glasgow in 2014 when he was just 20.
I felt like it was a big step up and I felt like I had a bit of imposter syndrome going there. I think the most exciting for me was the village, just being around all these other athletes from other sports. I think Usain Bolt was still competing and was there. So it was pretty surreal. I just turned 20 when I went and I didn't have the best experience performance-wise. So that's why I want to make amends, is going to these next games, hopefully with a chance to try and go and win and get on the podium would be nice.
You're not doing the 1500 though. There's a very special event that's been brought back. Tell us a little bit about what you're actually going to be doing in Glasgow.
So the 1500 for these games will be replaced by the mile. And that's the first time that's happened for a very long time. I think historically, way, way back, like decades ago, it was a mile. And then now it's bringing it back, which there isn't a championship that has a mile. It's always a 1500. So I hope that that makes the Commonwealth Games stand out. For those who don't know, it's 109 metres further. So for me, I'd rather it was 109 metres shorter, because I just prefer the shorter distance over the longer. But the race just will be a little bit longer. So I think the good thing about it is everyone knows about the 4-minute mile and Roger Bannister. And you can probably compare how we're running to landmarks such as that. It's a bit more relatable to the average person who maybe would go out for a run, have their watch in miles and know how quick they're running, and then they compare that to how quick we're running a mile. So it'd be nice, and it's nice if going forward the Commonwealth Games can keep a tradition of being the championships that host the mile.
Do your tactics change at all though? Because as you say, it's only another 100 metres or so, but of course when you've got that sprint finish going, it's a long way to carry on sprinting.
Yeah, the interesting thing about, if you think an extra 100 metres around the track, it means rather than starting on a straight like we normally would for the 1500, we actually start on a bend. So it means that you don't want to be running outside of lane one because you're running further if you're going around a bend in lane two. So everyone fights to get to the front a little bit more. So it's a bit more nerve-wracking at the start and it's a little bit more argy-bargy and you have to kind of be a bit more switched on from the gun. You generally will run a little bit slower through the 1500 just because you have got that extra 109 metres left. But the main thing is it should just still provide good racing, and that's what we hope that Commonwealth Games will provide. And it's exciting that you could be the first this era to go back and try and win the mile.
You've talked in the past about how realistically this is your last Commonwealth Games, given you came back from a load of injuries and you won that brilliant silver in Tokyo at the World Champs in September. Do you think things are coming together at the exact right time for you to perhaps upgrade those bronzes from those previous Commonwealth Games?
I hope so. It'd be a nice one to try and win. I think being from Scotland, that makes it a big incentive to try and win a Commonwealth, because you don't get to do that in a Scottish best and then have Flower Scotland playing. That's something a bit different. So that's definitely a big motivation. But I realise now that I don't have that many of each champ left. And yeah, it's my last Commonwealth, so it'd be nice to try and get a title from it, which I will aim to do.
Best of luck to him then next summer. And I don't know about you two, but I always want a run to be shorter.
Shorter to non-existent. Yes, exactly. Agree with you on that. Thank you, Natalie. It's 7:30. Tomorrow morning, a look at the award-winning book that sparked an online storm of criticism.
In 2021, my career, both in teaching and in writing, was suddenly taken away from me.
To some, the online furore went too far.
I do think it was a bit of a witch hunt.
But to others, it was entirely justified.
The language in this book is so dehumanising.
I'm Katie Razzle, the BBC's culture editor, and in a new series, I'll be finding out what happened across 6 episodes and different perspectives.
All of a sudden, not just books, but sentences and words became political.
Anatomy of a Cancellation starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds tomorrow morning at 9:30.
Quick look at the weather now today. Windy and cloudy with heavy spells of rain, mainly in northern and western areas.
Coming up in the next half hour, handball, offside, VAR. What would football look like if we redesigned it from scratch? A former England goalkeeper and some brilliant young players in Liverpool share their thoughts.
We'd just stop Manchester City playing. Isn't that one of the things we could do as a rule change? You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson at 29 minutes to 8. Tom Sanders has got a summary of the news for us.
The BBC has been given until Friday to respond to President Trump's threat of a $1 billion lawsuit over the way one of his speeches was edited in a Panorama documentary. The BBC has said it will reply in due course to Mr. Trump's demand for a full and fair retraction of the programme, which has sparked a major row about impartiality at the corporation. The BBC's Director General and Head of News both resigned on Sunday. MPs are expected to raise questions on the issue in the Commons today. Analysis by the BBC has found that just three out of the 121 NHS hospital trusts in England are meeting targets to treat cancer patients within 62 days of an urgent referral. Experts say timely treatment could improve survival rates. A government spokesperson said cancer care was a priority. United States senators have passed a budget measure to end the longest-running government shutdown in American history. Eight Democrats voted with Republicans to resume funding the federal government until the end of January. The legislation will need to be approved by the House of Representatives. Official figures released in the past hour show that the rate of unemployment in the UK rose by more than expected to 5% in the 3 months to September. That's up from 4.8% over 3 months prior. The Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi says those responsible for a car explosion in Delhi yesterday will be brought to justice. At least eight people were killed in the blast on a crowded road near the historic Red Fort. Security has been stepped up at sensitive public sites, including the Taj Mahal. The government is setting out plans to reduce testing on animals, except in exceptional circumstances. New technologies mean drugs can instead be tested on lab-grown human tissue or computer chips containing small amounts of cells. But there are concerns among some scientists that the move could alienate pharmaceutical companies.
Thank you, Tom. It's 27 minutes to 8. Let's explore more that story we were just hearing from Tom there. The story that the Science Minister, Lord Valence, is setting out a plan to deliver Labour's manifesto promise to work towards the phasing out of animal testing, looking at alternatives, growing cells in labs using AI models and the rest. Our science correspondent, Pala Ghosh, put to Lord Valence, who's a former president of research and development at the global pharmaceutical company GlaxoSmithKline, whether he could imagine a day where the use of animals in science would be close to zero.
Well, I think that is possible. Now, it's not possible anytime soon. And I think I want to set that expectation. The idea that we can eliminate animal use in the foreseeable future, I don't think is there. Can we get very close to it? I think we can. Can we push faster than we have been? I think we can. Should we? We absolutely should.
But we're not going to get there now. Indeed, last year there were over 2.5 million scientific procedures involving living animals carried out in the UK. Now, not all of those were for medical experiments. More than half were. Some were used for genetic testing. So let's explore the issues there with two professors, both, as it happens, from Queen Mary University of London. Professor Hazel Sheen joins us in the studio. She's co-director of the Centre for Predictive Vitro Models, which, as I think she'll explain, means alternative ways of testing things, and alongside her, Professor Francis Borkwell of the Barts Cancer Institute. Thank you very much indeed for coming into the Today studio. Professor Screen, first of all, we began to hear there from Patrick Valence the alternatives. What work are you doing that could start to replace using mice and rabbits, rats, fish, birds, dogs and the like?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's a range of different approaches we're starting to develop to look at alternatives. There are AI approaches that you can take, but the one that I'm particularly interested in and work on is what we call in vitro models. So we might take human cells, living human cells, and we effectively need to build an environment to house those cells so they behave in the same way as they do in the human body. And once you've got that, you've effectively got a small model replica of an organ or part of the body, and you can use that to do discovery science or to test drugs with.
Presumably it takes some years, though, maybe decades, to be sure that they are indeed behaving as a cell would behave in the body.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we're really sort of keen and looking at the moment is how we manage that process and think about the steps you need to take to ask exactly that question. So we'll talk about qualifying the model. So saying, how do we assess that the cells behave in the same way, take the same phenotype, as we call, so they behave in the same, we give the same function, and we can do things like ask if we can drive disease in exactly the same way as a model as we might do.
When I asked that question, Professor Bortwell, you nodded. Take some time. You're worried, are you, that we shouldn't go too fast?
I wouldn't say I'm worried. Over many, many decades, research using animals has made a major impact on the life sciences and every treatment that we have for disease. I think the concern in the community is that this may deprioritize animal research at the expense of the alternative methods. In my own lab, working in cancer research, over the last 10 years of working with some of Hazel's colleagues, we've been developing alternative methods. And our use of animals has really greatly reduced. But there comes a point where we need the complexity of the whole animal to test these new treatments for cancer.
Because what's happening in that petri dish may simply not replicate what's happening.
Exactly. You need to look at the interaction. Cancers are very complex rogue organs with 20 or so different cell types that are recruited and corrupted by the malignant cells to help them grow and spread. You can't model all of that in a petri dish.
But does it help you, Professor Screeton, as someone trying to develop these alternatives, to have sort of targets from government to get the push?
Absolutely. I think it's what we need to bring the field together. We need to work as a community to start to address this. I couldn't agree more, really. We need to really think about how we address some of these questions. It's about what we call context of use for a model. There is no way you can just replace an animal with a model and expect it to do the same thing.
Is there a danger, Professor Bortwell, that if people can't do that research on animals in this country, they'll simply do it somewhere else, those pharmaceutical firms?
I mean, this has been mentioned. I think it is a concern. And also for the scientific community at large, you know, in the UK, in terms of behavioural research, research into neurological disease, cancer research, as I mentioned, this may hold us back, if you like. But again, I agree with Hazel that these are exciting times to do this.
Well, that's
but
the interesting,
with caution.
The interesting thing, looking at you both and hearing you both, is far from, as it were, disagreeing, although you come at it from different perspectives and have different specialisms, it seems as if you feel, is this right, that you are allies in this search?
Absolutely. I think it's a hugely exciting time for the field. You can see the synergy of the latest biology coming together and giving us such an opportunity to address this. I think we need to be very careful in how we do it and how we manage that process and work together. But there's not a scientist out there that doesn't want to be looking at doing good science without the use of animals.
That's absolutely right. When we do research on animals, we sign up to the three R's: reduction, refinement, replacement. And I think that is in our minds the whole time. And we need to also refine the animal models, you know. So
phase out fine. What you'd both be nervous about would be, right, it stops, and it stops on day X.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Right. It's nice to have a discussion with agreement. Professor Francis Bortwell of Queen Mary University of London, Professor Hazel Screen, also of Queen Mary University of London. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
It is 20 to 8. Let's take agreement to firm disagreement, because the rules of football spend a lot of time being discussed, don't they? Is it because they need a revamp? Is it because they could be better? That in itself is a matter for debate. But what would we argue about if they changed? All of that to one side. BBC Sport has been asking players, pundits, even referees themselves, what one rule they would change if they were redesigning the game from scratch. Our reporter Katie Hazeldine has been to Malvern Primary School in Liverpool to speak to some young footballers about what they would change.
I'm Sophia, I'm 11 years old.
I'm 7 years old and my name's Cassidy Khan.
My name's George McGorry and I'm 11 years old.
I'm happy with most of the rules, but there's just a few rules that I'd change.
Go on, tell me about those.
Say if your foot's offside, the referee will say offside, but I think there should be freedom with the attacker and the defender for it to be offside, so like you can have your leg and your head offside as long as your back foot's on line with the defender.
You were not into that.
Yeah, I support Liverpool, and whenever Liverpool score, I like jump up and I celebrate, and then they say it's offside.
Did you have that on Sunday?
Yeah, I did, with Van Dijk's header, yeah.
1 minute each. Ready, number one. Off you go.
Tell me what you think works.
I'd say VAR, because the referee can't see everything with his point of view.
On penalties, I think it was in 2022, the AM said that you're not allowed to stutter step on pens, which I thought was a bit unfair, because it makes it much more easier for the goalkeepers to predict where you're taking the pen.
You all play football. I'm wondering if you've experienced anything whilst on the pitch as a player that you thought, oh, I wish the rules were a bit different, because that's just happened to me.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about it?
Our team didn't get a penalty when they fouled us, and then the other team, when they got fouled, they got a penalty.
Overall, are we happy with how the rules work?
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah, I think so, good.
I suppose it depends on the day, it depends which team you support a lot of the time, doesn't it?
Well, let's get the thoughts of Alan White, the Lionesses' all-time leading goal scorer. Good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
There was some real thought went into that. I enjoyed listening to them.
That is amazing. I love how, they're really thinking about it, so that's good.
Well, it's good that they're thinking about it and understanding it. It's good that they've got these creative ideas, which I think you've got a couple as well, haven't you?
Well, yeah, maybe I just like to cause maybe a little bit of chaos at football.
Oh,
right. Just the goalkeepers going up for every corner, I think would be quite fun. So Ooh. Maybe goalies scoring more goals, but then also maybe more counter-attacks happening the other way as well. So yeah, a little bit more chaos. But then I thought about it actually when I was just sat here and thought, it's a bit more running for goalkeepers, so they probably won't like that for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I was going to say the fitness level. I mean, not that I'm suggesting for 1 second that a keeper is not far fitter than me in the first instance, but yeah, there would be a lot more running involved, wouldn't there? Do you think there is... Because something, and we, you know, you heard the kids talk about VAR there, and as soon as something does change, everybody just jumps on it straight away, don't they? You just, there's not a great deal of necessarily evolution in the rules, is there?
No, yeah, it's been challenging, hasn't it, at times. I think it is needed, and I think there is needed for support for the referees, the officials, but then I think it's almost too close at times, and it's like, oh, can we give the benefit of doubt to the attacker, etc. So it is really challenging as well when you celebrate a goal and that emotion comes into it, and then suddenly the goal's called off for offside or handball or something else. So yeah, it's really challenging at times. It has, I think it has helped our game, but then I feel like all we talk about then is VAR now, rather than what's happening.
Well, I mean, there is an awful lot of talk about it, isn't there? I know you sort of quite like the idea as well of getting rid of the rule where you can't take your shirt off on the pitch. Oh, do you need to? Are there other things you need to do, Alan? Because that's completely fine if
you
do. No, don't worry.
I lost you there. Sorry.
Oh no, it's all right. We could hear your little one in the background, so I didn't know if you'd. No, it's fine. I didn't
She's
know if
downstairs.
You'd been.
Sorry.
I didn't know if you'd been called away to mum duties, which is far more important than talking to me.
No, don't worry.
We were talking about the rule that says you can't take your shirt off on the pitch. You would quite like to change that one as well.
Yeah. Again, I think that comes down to emotion, really. I think, you know, I've been very lucky to experience scoring goals, and I think it just takes over you. And I think, yeah, removing your shirt, or even just the manager sprinting down and just joining in the celebrations, and just, I think, yeah, you should be able to just enjoy that emotion and that real amazing experience that you can have with your teammates and the fans as well. And yeah, I don't really think taking a shirt will cause too many problems, I don't think. I think that should be allowed, and just to have that raw emotion of scoring a goal, you should just let that happen.
Yeah. I mean, as we said at the start, this is something that BBC Sport have done, where they've just asked people what they think should change. But do you think it's something that the wider game should do more officially? Is it time to actually say to players, but to say to the fans as well, realistically, what do you think we should update?
Yeah, I think it's a great thing to think about and see exactly what everyone is thinking. Has everyone got the same consensus? I know our ones are a little bit of fun at the same time, but I think it's good to hear what the fans think, what the players think, and you know, the clubs as well, to see how we can improve football and make it as exciting and for fans and everyone involved. So yeah, I think it's a great thing. I think it is great to maybe think of some obscure ones as well. But yeah, I think at the time we should just keep evolving our game for the viewers and for the fan experience and for players as well on the pitch, so they get the best possible outcome for themselves.
Yeah, I do like your idea of causing a little bit of chaos. Ellen White, Lionesses' all-time leading goal scorer, thanks for joining us.
I think she was saying, Mummy, can you explain the offside rule?
Oh, very which, possibly, which yeah. would take a long time.
Yeah, I'm not sure I get it. 14 minutes to eight now, and time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Mona Siddiqui, Professor of Religion and Society at King's College London.
Good morning. Today, on Armistice Day, we will share a two-minute silence at 11 o'clock. It's a sacred kind of silence, honouring the lives lost, the grief that never found words, and the courage that often went unseen. At a time when so many question what holds our nation together, this poignant moment of remembering, which stretches across schools, streets and offices, is a collective act of silent gratitude. There's a silence that heals and a silence that can harm. For the controversy unfolding at the top of the BBC, the accusation against the organisation isn't only one of bias, but also of silence. A silence by those who took too long to admit mistakes, to explain, to restore confidence. The delay in coming forward has challenged accountability, trust, and the future of a national institution on which we rely and which many of us cherish. And then there's a kind of silence which in our personal lives can feel like a betrayal, making you doubt the very foundations of a relationship. When you want someone to have the courage to admit that they're wrong, but they don't. When you want someone to be there for you when you're hurting, but they're not. And when you want someone to be happy for you, to share in your joy, but they stay quiet. This is the kind of silence that wounds, heavy and sharp. In leadership, in friendship, in family and in public life, cruelty is often quiet. In an age of endless noise and opinion, silence can seem like an absence, but many thinkers, Eastern and Western, regarded silence as a form of discipline. Pythagoras, who required his students to train in silence for years, the Indian poet-philosopher Allama Iqbal, who saw silence as a dynamic space of spiritual work, of self-realization, a kind of discipline that doesn't offer escape, but clarity. It gives us time to hear the voice of conscience, the whisper of remembrance and the guidance of God. And the Persian scholar and poet Rumi, who wrote that silence is a language of God, all else is poor translation. It takes courage to know when to be silent and when to speak up. Both are moral choices we all face every day. So as a two-minute silence ends today and the sound of life returns, I will reflect on how silence not only enables us to remember, but carries with it the weight and hope of living differently.
That was Thought for the Day with Mona Siddiqui, Professor of Religion and Society at King's College London. It is just coming round to 10 to 8.
Fresh strike action by junior doctors, now known as resident doctors, could wipe out the recovery the NHS has been making since the pandemic. That at least is the warning coming from NHS providers, the organisation which represents NHS trusts in England. It says the strikes risk progress on patient care, safety and health service budgets. And we're joined by the chief executive of NHS providers, Daniel Elkalis, as well as the deputy chair of the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, which has rejected the latest offer by the government, which is offering to cover the cost of exam fees and expand medical training places, but not putting up pay in the way that the BMA is demanding. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Morning.
Let's start with the good news, shall we, Daniel, because people want to hear that in the health service. You've done a survey of your members saying that before these strikes, you think things are getting better.
So absolutely. We mustn't underestimate the scale of the challenge the NHS faces, whether it's corridor care, long waits for mental health, or delays in cancer care that you've also reported this morning. But when the Secretary of State came into power, he said the NHS is broken. And what this survey shows, it's a huge survey across the NHS, that actually there are now quite a lot of green shoots of recovery. We've got more organisations saying they're providing high quality care. We've got more organisations saying they've got enough staff and the rightly skilled staff. And for the first time in years, we actually have the majority of organisations saying they're going to deliver their financial plan. And what would be so disappointing is if this like size 10 boot of industrial action comes and squashes all these green shoots of grass. That would be so bad for the recovery of the NHS, really bad for patients and really bad for staff. So,
Dr. Emma Runswick, a size 10 boot, why are you going to do it?
Well, I think it's quite surprising to hear that from Daniel, because my reading of the report was very different. I think almost half of providers don't think that they're providing high quality care. Two in three worried about having capacity to meet demand in the future. They know that NHS staff morale is, quote, rock bottom. And that's because they're being asked to make cuts. A quarter have cut services, a fifth have closed services completely, 29% have cut clinical jobs. And they're worried about finance and capital. Those are all concerns that we as doctors share. The quotes here are saying, directors are saying, we need to invest to save. And we are saying, if we want to fix the NHS for patients in the future, we need to ensure that doctors we have trained are able to get jobs, while at the same time we keep the ones we do have by valuing them properly. And we've put lots of proposals to the government to enable us to do that, to wipe out the possibility of strike action for the entirety of this parliament, multi-year deals, prioritisation for doctors who work here in the NHS already for jobs. And we had last year 30,000 doctors applying for 10,000 posts. This is a completely ridiculous position when we have so many people waiting to see GPs on corridors in A&E. You know, we can fix this. Unfortunately, the government has not shifted to fix it yet. And unfortunately, strike action is the position that we've been pushed to get them to pay attention.
Well, that is the case that is made by the BMA, Daniel Eccles of NHS Providers. Just spell out in more detail why you call strike action a size 10 boot. What would it do if it goes ahead this week?
So I think the first thing to say is these are green shoots of recovery, and they're not even, and they're not everywhere. So they need nurturing. But I'm really optimistic from having gone around the country, and I've visited 40 places in the last 5 months. There is amazing stuff happening in every part of the NHS, and we need it to come to the fore and to grow. The challenge with industrial action is that it distracts everybody from being able to do all the things they want to do to improve care, because all effort has to go into maintaining patient safety. And no matter how hard we try, some patients will come to harm in industrial action. So the NHS needs all of its workforce at work.
So to be clear, Mr. Eccles, you're saying it's not just a cost, and I'll put this to Dr. Runswick in a second, it's not just the cost of industrial action in financial terms, you're also saying, and to the patients potentially, you're saying that there's a cost in just a massive distraction.
Absolutely, because we have to prioritise keeping patients safe and mitigating the actions of the resident doctors, which means other people are doing their jobs when they're on strike.
Well, let's go back to Dr. Runswick of the BMA. Look, there is an actual cost, isn't there? The King's Fund said all the strike action in the year 23-24 cost the NHS around £1.7 billion. That's money that can't go for better training and better pay.
Absolutely. And it's amazing, really, that the government choose to continue that strategy, because that more than covers the entire cost of the pay restoration demand we made during that industrial action. They could have completely settled the dispute without any of the distraction that Daniel is talking about, because we agree. I mean, I work in child and adolescent mental health at the moment. You know, I know what the waiting list is like. I see the kids with ADHD who've waited for far too long to access treatment. And we want, just like NHS leaders want, our NHS service to be good. That's what I've trained for.
But the government are not going to give you the money, and you know this, Dr. Runswick, don't you? I mean, Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, says you've had a pay increase of almost 29% across the last 3 years. You've got the highest pay increase across the public sector this year of 5.4%. And he's made absolutely clear he's not going to budge. So are you not just damaging the very institution and the very budgets that you need?
I mean, we are still 20% real terms pay cuts against 2008.
Yeah, and but we if have you take a different forward, baseline, that doesn't work, does it? If you take a later baseline, you've increased pay.
We have put forward lots of very sensible...
Is that right, that you've increased
sensible,
pay if you take a different baseline?
We take the beginning of our pay cuts, which is the beginning of austerity. So if you, we have put forward lots of very reasonable proposals for multi-year deals, increasing wages by something like £1 an hour over the next few years, each of those next few years. We have put forward proposals to prioritise UK-based doctors for jobs when we have thousands of doctors unable to get into the system, to get into training, to become the surgeons, the psychiatrists of the future.
Okay, let
that
me turn
an
to
obscene
Daniel
Ailkeley's situation. They can fix that problem. They have the money to fix that problem if they choose to have to fix that problem and to fix the NHS for the future.
Time, sorry to interrupt you, but it's just time is short. Daniel Ailkeley's, the truth is, if Dr. Rumswick didn't speak for many resident or junior doctors, the strikes wouldn't happen. She evidently does, doesn't she? Isn't that what your members say?
Well, I think 2 points. Firstly, the resident doctors have quite rightly said that their working conditions and their training aren't good enough. And the government have recognised that, and that's a seminal report which says we have to sort out medical training to make it fit for the future, and we have to sort out resident doctors' working conditions. And all our members are absolutely determined to do that. This strike starts on Friday. Both the BMA and the government have said they want to talk to resolve the dispute. And I would just urge both parties, and in particular the resident doctors, to take the Secretary of State's up on his
let me give Dr. Rumswick the
talk.
Last word, but I'm afraid, Emma, it has to be about 10 seconds. You will talk again, will you?
Oh, of course. We want to see a multi-year deal and a fix for this jobs crisis. And I think Streeting can do that if he chooses to.
Dr. Emma Rumswick of the BMA, Daniel Ailkeley's of NHS Providers. Thanks for joining us.
In the heart of Zambia.
On BBC iPlayer.
This is the remarkable story of four rival families. Lions, leopards, hyenas, and wild dogs. We will see these rivals compete to stake their claim on this land. Some will rise, others will fall. Who will rule?
Kingdom, with Sir David Attenborough. Watch all episodes on BBC iPlayer.
Let's get the weather forecast. Here's Simon King.
Thank you, Anna. For Wales, southwest England, the Midlands, eastern and southeastern areas of England, we've still got some showery rain about this morning, but much of the heavy rain has started to clear to the north. There'll be some brighter skies developing, but for Wales and southwest England, some heavier rain will spread its way in during this afternoon. And for South Wales and southwest England in particular, the rain heavy and persistent could bring some localised flooding later. Maximum temperatures today getting up to about 12 to 15 degrees with a rather brisk southwesterly wind. Now, for northwest and northeast England, the rain has started to move its way in. It'll turn quite heavy as we go through this morning, but it will clear to the north and turning drier later. A few brighter spells in northeast England, highs of 12 to 15 degrees. But it's for Northern Ireland, central and southern Scotland, where rain already this morning moving in is going to be persistent really throughout into the afternoon. And as I said, particularly heavy around southwest Scotland and Northern Ireland, where there could be some localised flooding into the afternoon. Maximum temperatures getting to about 10. to 14 degrees. It's in northern Scotland where we'll have some sunshine through this morning, continuing for much of the day. It's only by this evening that the cloud and the rain will start to move in from the south, with maximum temperatures about 9 to 11 degrees Celsius. Tonight, the rain will continue in northern Scotland and across into East Anglia and the southeast by tomorrow morning.
Simon, thank you. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 11th of November. The headlines this morning, MPs are due to discuss claims of bias at the BBC as the corporation considers how to respond to President Trump's threat of a $1 billion lawsuit. After the news, we'll hear from a Trump confidant, the boss of the US news network Newsmax.
The rate of unemployment in the UK rose to 5% in the 3 months to September, its highest level since 2021. And new analysis has found that only a tiny number of England's NHS trusts are meeting targets for treating cancer patients quickly enough.
Still to come in the next hour of the programme, the Booker Prize winner David Soloy, whose novel Flesh explores the three stages of modern man, will join us live in the Today studio. And
I want to be 14 again, tattoo myself with a fountain pen, pretend to like the taste of rum and coke.
The unmistakable sound of Victoria Wood, a new musical called 14 Again, and a theatre in the Lake District. It's going to be named after her to celebrate the comedian. We'll speak to some of those behind the project. Before that, the BBC News is read by Tom Sanders.
Lawyers acting for President Trump have given the BBC until Friday evening to respond to his threat of a $1 billion lawsuit over the way one of his speeches was edited in an episode of Panorama. The BBC has said that it will reply in due course to Mr. Trump's demand for a full and fair retraction of the documentary, which has sparked a major row about impartiality at the corporation. The BBC's Director General and Head of News both resigned on Sunday, and today MPs were expected to discuss the issue when they return to Westminster, as our political correspondent Ben Wright explains.
A debate in the Commons on the turmoil at the BBC is likely, with the government expected to repeat Downing Street's view. The Number 10 does not believe the corporation is institutionally biased, but wants to see mistakes corrected quickly. The Conservatives and Reform UK have been far more critical of the BBC's internal culture. Yesterday, the BBC's chairman, Samir Shah, strongly rejected claims of systemic bias and dismissed allegations that members of the corporation's board had orchestrated a politically motivated coup as a fanciful notion. But both the Liberal Democrats and the SNP are calling for the removal of one of the BBC's board members, Sir Robbie Gibb. A former senior editor at the BBC who was director of communications for Theresa May in Downing Street. The Lib Dem leader Sir Ed Davey said to ensure the BBC's independence and impartiality, Sir Robbie should have no role in appointing the new Director General. Sir Robbie hasn't responded to all this yet. The Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch said the focus should be on the mistakes made rather than chasing people because of their political opinions.
Official figures show that the rate of unemployment in the UK rose to 5% in the 3 months to September. That's the highest level since 2021. The Office for National Statistics said the figures pointed to a weakening of the labour market. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
Unemployment rose to its highest level in 4.5 years in the 3 months to the end of September, increasing to 5% from 4.8%. The number of people on company payrolls fell by 180,000 in the year to October. This was more than forecasters had expected. Wage growth also slowed, although it continued to outpace inflation. Analysts said uncertainty over what the budget will contain, with tax increases widely expected, had made employers reluctant to hire new people. The business group, the Institute of Directors, said the government must use the budget to implement sensible changes to its employment reforms and avoid tax-raising measures. Experts said the figures opened the way for the Bank of England to make further cuts in interest rates.
The US Senate has approved a measure to end the longest shutdown of the federal government in American history. Democrats have been demanding that Republicans first agree an extension of health care subsidies, but 8 Democrats broke ranks to give the stopgap bill enough votes to pass. It'll go to the House of Representatives for approval before it can be sent to President Trump's desk to be signed. Some Democrats have called for the removal of the party's leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, for failing to prevent the defections. Analysis by the BBC has revealed that just 3 NHS hospital trusts out of 121 in England are meeting health service targets for treating cancer patients quickly enough. Treatment is meant to begin within 62 days of an urgent referral. The government is set to publish a new cancer strategy early next year, but the Nuffield Trust think tank says it'll be incredibly challenging to make meaningful progress on waiting times. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
NHS trusts in England are required to hit targets for patients to be diagnosed within 28 days of a referral, then a wait of no more than a month, with a total waiting time for treatment of 62 days. BBC analysis covered performance by trusts between September 2024 and August this year, and found that while only a handful were hitting all 3 targets, nearly a quarter were missing all of them. Experts say timely treatment can improve survival rates. The government is due to publish a cancer strategy for England early next year, and a spokesperson said cancer care was a priority after the NHS had faced a decade of neglect. But the Nuffield Trust think tank said the reality was it would be incredibly challenging to make meaningful progress on waiting times when finances were so tight.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has vowed to bring to justice those responsible for a car explosion in Delhi yesterday that killed at least 8 people. 20 others were injured by the blast, which happened on a crowded road near the capital's historic Red Fort. Police have launched an investigation under India's main anti-terror law, and security has been heightened at sensitive public sites across the country, including the Taj Mahal. Health leaders are warning that a strike over pay by resident doctors in England, due to start on Friday, could wipe out a once-in-a-generation chance to fix the health service. NHS Providers, which represents trusts, says the five-day walkout could crush what it called the fragile, hard-won progress of recent months. Its chief executive, Daniel Elkeles, told us that it was crucial to allow the NHS to continue its recovery.
We've got more organisations saying they're providing high quality care. We've got more organisations saying they've got enough staff and the rightly skilled staff. And for the first time in years, we actually have the majority of organisations saying they're going to deliver their financial plan. And what would be so disappointing is if this like size 10 boot of industrial action comes and squashes all these green shoots of grass.
The Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, says the government can stop the strike by making doctors a decent offer, but ministers have insisted they will not negotiate on pay. Dr. Emma Runswick from the BMA told us the government must show more flexibility.
We've put lots of proposals to the government to wipe out the possibility of strike action for the entirety of this parliament. Multi-year deals, prioritisation for doctors who work here in the NHS already for jobs. We can fix this. Unfortunately, the government has not shifted to fix it yet. And unfortunately, strike action is the position that we've been pushed to get them to pay attention.
More than 900 people have been arrested in raids on high street premises, including vape shops, barbers and takeaways, in a month-long operation led by the National Crime Agency. More than 340 notices for illegal working and renting were issued, which could see businesses and landlords fined tens of thousands of pounds. The NCA said the threat from organised high street criminality needed a national approach. Thailand's defence minister has announced that the country is pausing the US-brokered ceasefire agreement it signed with Cambodia last month. The return of 18 Cambodian prisoners of war held by the Thai military will no longer take place. Tensions between the Southeast Asian neighbours escalated yesterday when 4 Thai soldiers were injured by a landmine. 5 leading debt organisations have told the BBC they're seeing a rise in the number of people seeking help after using Buy Now, Pay Later credit. Such arrangements allow people to spread interest-free purchases over weekly or monthly instalments. Affordability checks are less stringent. Customers who've been rejected for a credit card can often still sign up. Stephanie Miskin reports.
Some families have been taking on Buy Now Pay Later debt for everyday items, from weekly food shops to school uniforms and bus passes. But debt advice services say using such forms of credit can be an unsustainable way of plugging the gap in the family budget. This year, thousands of people have contacted advisors after struggling to repay the money. One organisation, Money Wellness, says it's helped 40% more people with Buy Now Pay Later debts in the year to September compared with last year. From next summer, all Buy Now Pay Later schemes will be regulated, leading to stricter affordability checks. Buy Now Pay Later companies told the BBC their products had safeguards to help manage customer spending, and they offered support for those getting into financial difficulty.
The British-Hungarian author David Soloy has been awarded the Booker Prize for his novel Flesh, which follows the life of a Hungarian man who ends up in the company of London's super rich. The book was praised for its minimalist dialogue, pared-down descriptions and blank pages left to represent grief. Speaking at last night's ceremony, David Soloy said novelists should feel able to try out new styles.
Fiction can take risks. Part of the reason for that is just that novels are so relatively cheap to produce. All you need to do is keep one writer supplied with coffee and a few other essentials for a year or two, and you've got a novel. I mean, it's almost free.
And we'll hear from David Solloy later on in the programme.
Thank you, Tom. It is 10 minutes past eight. Friday, November the 14th, 5 p.m. Eastern Time. That is the deadline that Donald Trump's lawyers have given the BBC to respond to their threat of legal action. A £1 billion lawsuit, they say they'll file in the state of Florida over the disputed Panorama episode, which aired days before last year's presidential election. They want the BBC to fully retract the programme, which cut together two parts of the president's January the 6th speech ahead of the Capitol riots and made him look, ultimately, like he said something that he didn't, maliciously and intentionally, according to the legal letter that's been served on the corporation. Mr. Trump also wants an apology and, crucially, compensation for the overwhelming financial and reputational harm that he says he suffered. It's worth noting that for the court action in the US to happen, the Panorama episode in question needed to have been screened there. Now, the BBC hasn't confirmed at this point whether it actually was. The BBC has said that it's reviewing the letter and will respond in due course. Licence fee payers are already asking whether their money would be used as part of any financial settlement that might be reached with the president. Well, a legal commentator, Joshua Rosenberg, has written a piece this morning asking the question, will Trump sue? And joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
There's a lot of complexity, so I'm sure you can simplify this for us, as you're so good at doing it. He has the legal ability to sue in the US.
He has the legal ability to sue, and he wants to sue in Florida. I'm sure he would argue that the programme Panorama was available on BBC iPlayer really throughout the world until very recently. If you look at the BBC's response published yesterday to complaints about the programme, it says, while this programme is over a year old and consequently no longer available to watch on BBC iPlayer, we've received new complaints. We can infer from that that it was available to watch until the end of last month, around the 28th of October, and if it was available on iPlayer, it could be watched in Florida.
And what about the laws in the US on defamation and free speech? How do they compare to the ones we have here?
Generally speaking, there is respect for freedom of expression in the US, perhaps more than in the UK. Generally speaking, you might have to show that if you're claiming you've been defamed, that the person you're accusing acted with malice. So there are definitely restrictions on being able to sue and arguments that can be put. But I think it's worth looking at what happens in the real world. Your colleague Katie Razzle is reporting today that recently Paramount Global paid President Trump $16 million to settle a dispute over an interview broadcast on CBS with the former Vice President Kamala Harris. ABC News paid him $15 million to settle a defamation lawsuit after its anchor falsely claimed he'd been found liable for rape. So you can see that even in the United States, media organizations don't want to test how the courts would operate. They think it's more appropriate and perhaps will save money in the long run to settle by paying quite substantial sums of money.
And to be clear, what the BBC can't do is simply ignore this. They need to engage.
I would advise them to engage because I don't think they want to call the president's bluff. Yet certainly, as you've said, the president's lawyer in Florida is saying that the president wants the BBC to respond by the end of this week. And he's making three requests, demands, if you like. First of all, a full retraction. Secondly, an apology. And thirdly, appropriately to compensate President Trump. Now, what appropriately means is obviously a matter for negotiation.
Thank you for joining us, Joshua Rosenberg. We can also speak to Chris Ruddy, the founder and chief executive of Newsmax Media. It's one of America's most prominent conservative news outlets. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be on with you.
It's good to talk to you. Joshua Rosenberg was talking there about some of the legal cases that President Trump has already brought that other news organizations have already settled with him. Why is it important for him to actually make these legal, to take them to that conclusion?
Well, I think the president is trying to make a point. I think he initially started by saying that he had been defamed by these companies. ABC, for instance, had accused him, George Stephanopoulos had accused him of rape. While somebody had alleged that, Gene Carroll, in a New York civil court, it was never proven. The court never ruled that he engaged in rape. It was a rather, in my mind, frivolous case because the lady had no evidence she had ever been with the president. There was no witnesses. Happened over 25 years before. It was a very apparently fanciful story. And the president, he's been in litigation with her over that, over libel claims. So, well, that has continued. The fact is, I'm from the state of Florida. I'm very familiar with the Florida libel laws. So I have no doubt the BBC misrepresented what the president said. And that's pretty clear. I think everybody agrees. Otherwise, you wouldn't have had those resignations. I'm also very assured that if the BBC took the case to court, they would prevail. They would prevail because the state of Florida has pretty strong libel laws that defend media companies and free speech. What's happening is that a lot of media companies would prefer not to go through the media spectacle of all this.
I wonder, Chris, because what he is asking for is an apology and also a retraction. And when I look at the statement, the response from the BBC's chairman yesterday, it's very clear. It says the conclusion of further reflection by the BBC is that we accept that the way the speech was edited did give the impression of a direct call for violent action. The BBC would like to apologise for that error of judgment. So they have accepted that they were wrong and they have apologised. Financial compensation is part of this, but how much does President Trump need or want that money?
Well, I think he sees these as victories. I mean, I've talked to him about the CBS and the ABC case, and he sees this as legitimizing his claims that there's fake news, that the news is out to get him. I think there's a feeling that the media in America is quite weaponized. I don't think the public thinks that Newsmax is weaponized against the president. We do give both sides about him and his policies, but we don't go out every day trying to. And we certainly wouldn't edit a video clip about him or even President Biden or anyone. And the fact you're seeing this now in major media is very disappointing. I congratulate that the BBC and people resigned and they were held accountable. I think in American media organizations, oftentimes you don't see that. And there's not a sense of accountability. But the president sees this, I think, as a big victory for him in his claim the media is out to get him.
You're a longtime friend of his. And it's also interesting that the BBC is obviously a big organisation in the UK, but far less influential in the US. And I think it's fair to say many people in the US would not have seen that programme and perhaps are only becoming aware of it because of the reporting and because of the lawsuit that the President Trump is being, you know, is talking about launching. Why is the BBC so important to him? Does he see that as a challenge to his power?
Well, I don't think he's as threatened by the BBC as he would be ABC, CBS, or NBC, or complaining about them as much. This obviously has made global headlines. The BBC is very respected. It may not be extremely influential or watched, but it's very has been traditionally very respected. So for the BBC to weigh in and say that the president promoted violence on January 6th, which he denies, and the tape of his speech shows that he didn't promote it. In fact, he called for a peaceful march that day. And there's a lot of complexity. I've seen some of the British reports on what happened on January 6th. And I find that these reports are oftentimes wrong about, you know, the Capitol building's a public building. There's nothing wrong about going in the building. People were arrested and thrown in jail, sometimes solitary confinement for 6 months just for walking in the public building, not for rioting, not for assaulting anyone. Very strange situation we had. I think that is a threat to democracy. So the president, I think, is using these as examples. He may very well sue BBC because he's had a winning record on bringing these suits.
Would it, Chris, make any difference to him? And it may not. The fact that the BBC is funded very differently to some of those commercial organisations that he sued already. The fact that the BBC is funded through this licence fee model, so is paid for essentially by ordinary people in the UK who watch television. Would that have any impact on his decision to take financially that money, do you think?
I don't think so. I think that he feels that they're a very big, well-funded organisation, and if they did him wrong, then, and he can be compensated for that, I think he sees that as a win for him. And a win for truth. I do think that it doesn't hurt his relationship. He has a very good relationship with Keir Starmer. he certainly widely respects King Charles. He does not see this as impinging at all on the very good relationship that he has with Britain. I was with him at Windsor Castle when he was there, and I think him and Melania felt that was one of the high points of his presidency so far. So I think there's very good relations there. I think this is just a function of the BBC. And as you know, there's a lot of criticism of the BBC that's gone on about bias, not just here in the United States, but in Britain, around the world. And it's increasingly true of American media that they've become extremely politicized. And I think it's a wake-up call for the media that they not go to excess.
Chris Gruddy, really interesting to talk to you. Thank you. Founder and chief executive of Newsmax Media, longtime friend of President Trump. We were also talking to Joshua Rosenberg, the legal commentator, about, well, the quite complex legal background to this, the fact that Donald Trump is suing in the US state of Florida, and part of the, well, whether or not he has a case or not, essentially, is whether or not this program was shown in the US. And the BBC is still looking at that. This particular episode of Panorama was not shown on the global feed of the BBC News Channel, which is available in the US. It wasn't shown there. We were talking about iPlayer. Joshua Rosenberg was making the very good point that it was on iPlayer, but iPlayer is only available to people watching within the UK. So I think we'll sort of continue to wait and see. There's lots of sort of complicated legal background to all of this, but that provides a little bit of extra detail for you too.
21 minutes past eight. Were you listening last night here on Radio 4 when the winner of the Booker Prize was announced at a star-studded ceremony in London? In case you missed it, here's the moment that every author dreams of.
So the winner of the 2025 Booker Prize for Fiction is Flesh by David Saloy, who's just about standing up now, I think, a little bit shocked.
A little bit shocked. He's shocked still. He's in the studio with us, the British-Hungarian writer. Congratulations, David.
Thank you very much.
You've got plenty of coffee there. Presumably you need it.
I absolutely do. I feel like I've had a nap, basically, since all of that last night. So, but I'm running on adrenaline and I'll be fine.
I want to talk about what it means to you and why you wrote what you did. But just before I do, let's play to listeners who haven't perhaps had a chance to read the book a little extract of your novel Fleshed, which charts the rise of a boy from a housing estate in Hungary to the mansions of London's super rich. Last night at the ceremony in London, the rapper Stormzy, who's a great fan of the book, recorded this extract.
After only a few days, it's unbearable not to see her at all. Not to know where she is or what she's doing. Even her hatred and anger would be preferable to that, is what he feels. And it's with that feeling that he knocks on the door of her flat one evening. He isn't sure exactly why he's doing it or what he will say.
Stormzy there reading Flesh, all about the story of Isfan. And it seems to me, is this right, that the character in your novel, rather like you, unsure, where's home?
Absolutely, yeah. It was something when I started work on this book, that I had very consciously in mind, because I obviously grew up in this country and lived here until my late 30s. But by the time I started work on this book, I'd already lived in Hungary for some years. And I'll never, even despite the fact that I have a Hungarian family background on one side, I never will feel totally sort of at home in Hungary, if you like. And by the time I started writing this book, I'd also, to some extent, lost touch with England, London, as you do if you live away from a place for many years. And so I wanted to use that feeling somehow in the book.
And the story, which we obviously don't want to plot spoil, you want people to buy the book, which no doubt they will in large numbers now. But the idea of this poor Hungarian boy suddenly rising to riches here.
Yeah, it's a, I mean, I suppose I wanted to write a story of modern Europe in a way as well. I mean, the book takes place over many decades, starting in the late 1980s and coming right up to the present. And it's a sort of tale of modern Europe, yes.
A tale of modern Europe and a tale of men. Many people say that not just this work, but your previous work looks at men and masculinity, the three ages of men. Were you consciously trying to say something about the role of men now?
I mean, I knew that that was part of what the book was about, absolutely, of course. But I don't think I had an agenda, if you like. I didn't have any specific points I was trying to make. I think what I find interesting about writing is actually specifically when I don't know exactly what it is that I'm trying to say, and when the act of writing itself becomes a kind of exploration of something. So I didn't go into it with a specific idea, no.
And you leave a lot of, I'm not sure the word work is quite right, but you leave a lot for the reader to do. It's been noted that in the book, there's no description of what this guy, Isfan, is like. There's a lot of white on the page, the chair of the Booker Prize judges, Roddy Doyle, pointed out. The dialogue is very sparse, a conscious decision.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the book is, any book, any good book is about the power and the possibility of language, but this book is also, I think, about the limitations of language, and it's about, there's a sort of silence. It has a sort of quality of silence at certain points and which runs through it.
To be clear, when I say sparse dialogue, it will be phrases like, you okay? Yes. Okay.
Sure, sure. I mean, I wanted the dialogue to be very realistic. I think that the sort of, I think it's very important to this book to have a very strong sense of realism, which I hope it does have, and in order for it to make its emotional impact that I hope it does make.
Now, talking about emotional impact, let's talk about the emotional impact of winning. I was lucky enough to be sitting in the chair behind you, watching you as the news was read out that you had won. And when you got onto the stage, you reminded people that you had actually worked, written an entire novel that you'd binned after many years' work. I mean, this is the peak.
Yes.
There are big troughs too, aren't there?
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, it really is. It's obviously a moment like that, you inevitably think of the sort of the difficult moments that are involved as well. And I mean, last night I very successfully persuaded myself that I wasn't going to win in order to have as stress-free experience as possible during the actual evening.
And I wasn't stress-free.
I was actually, I was sort of eerily calm. I did almost too well in that, so that when it did happen, I was sort of slightly, there was a sort of sense of shock, yeah.
You prepared for what's to come, because Roddy Doyle, who handed you the award, jokingly gave you a bit of advice on the stage, didn't he? He said, turn down everything, you are going to be in demand.
I'm not sure he was joking, he speaks from experience, but yes, it's obviously about striking a balance, because I do want to write another book. And in fact, I'm already, you have to, I mean, the Flesh was finished 2 years ago. I mean, there's a sort of long lag time with the editing and publication of a book. So I've already started something else, and I need to leave some space for that.
And you know what it's like to lose the Booker as well as to win it?
I do. In 2016, I was shortlisted and didn't win, which is probably why I went to such great lengths yesterday to try and sort of preserve my sanity by that little strategy of convincing myself I wasn't going to win. Yes, it's a very intense evening, win or lose. And
but winning's better.
Winning's better on balance, yeah.
David Saloy, many, many congratulations.
Thank you,
the book is Flesh. I have read it. It is a cracker. You will enjoy every single page of it. So thank you very much indeed for coming in.
Thank you.
28 minutes past eight now. Time for the sport. Natalie's back.
Chelsea boss Sonia Bonpasta says goalkeeper Hannah Hampton hasn't travelled for their Women's Champions League match against Sandpulten in Austria tonight after she picked up an injury against Arsenal at the weekend. But Lauren James is in contention to make her first appearance for Chelsea this season. Meanwhile, Blues midfielder Kira Walsh has responded to the news that Arsenal defender Katie Reid has suffered an anterior cruciate ligament injury in training and will miss the rest of the season. Reid is the latest in a long line of women since the start of the campaign in September to have this issue.
I think the governing bodies need to listen to the players. I think maybe sometimes we do play too many games in the congested fixtures. There's not enough time. I think we're the ones ultimately who are going through it. So, like, yeah, you can do the research, but ultimately you need to listen to the ones who are going through it and, yeah, how we can best find solutions for that going forward.
In tennis, the big talking point is whether Jannik Sinner or Carlos Alcaraz will finish the year as world number one. Second seed Sinner began his ATP Finals title defence with a win against a physically hampered Felix Auger-Aliassime at the last tournament of the season in Turin.
He's one of the toughest players to beat. Then on 6-5 SI, he struggled physically, and you know, you don't want to win obviously in this way, but you know, in the other way you take it. We only wish him a speedy recovery. Hopefully he gets back 100%. We need him in this competition, you know, he's one of the top 8 players.
And former world number two, Ange Boer, will be delaying her return to the court as she's announced she's having her first baby. The three-time Grand Slam finalist has been on a break from the tour since her first round exit from Wimbledon in July. In rugby union, England have injury concerns over back Tommy Freeman and second row Ollie Chesham ahead of their autumn international against New Zealand on Saturday. Both missed training yesterday with injuries. England flanker Sam Underhill is ready for a tough test against the All Blacks.
It's exciting to play against good players, especially Ardie Surveyor's been consistently one of the best back rows in the world for a number of years now. So playing against guys like him is brilliant. Same goes for Wallace Asiti. He's a very, very good player. Playing for England especially, you want to be playing against the best and you want to be challenging yourself. And there's no better challenge than a team like the All Blacks and the talent that they have and the ability they have.
And Amila Aswat has made history at Kempton, becoming the first black British female jump jockey to ride in Britain. The 20-year-old finished 5th of 10 aboard the Kim Bailey and Matt Nichols trained Gudchen in the handicap hurdle.
Thank you very much indeed. And let's talk about what's coming up just after 9 here on Radio 4. It's the Life Scientific, says Jim Al-Khalili.
Hello. This week, the COP30 climate summit is taking place in the Brazilian city of Belém, a gateway to the Amazon, which continues to face widespread deforestation. We all know that our climate is changing and that we're largely responsible for this, but we can't tackle the problem unless we understand what's going on. And guess what? It's complicated. One scientist who's done more than most to rectify this is Pierre Friedlingstein. He's one of the world's leading climate modellers whose work on how the carbon cycle influences the Earth's climate will be central at COP30. But Pierre practices what he preaches. He won't himself be there so as to minimise his own carbon footprint. That's the Life Scientific after the news at 9, or catch up on BBC Sounds.
The weather today doesn't really offer a great deal, I'm afraid. It's windy, cloudy, heavy spells of rain, mainly in northern and western areas.
Stay in, switch up the radio, that's the answer. It's 28 minutes to 9. Tom Sanders is here with a summary of the news.
The BBC has been given until Friday to respond to President Trump's threat of a $1 billion lawsuit over the way Panorama edited a clip of one of his speeches. He wants the programme to be retracted and receive an apology. MPs are expected to raise questions about the issue in the Commons today. Official figures show that the rate of unemployment in the UK rose by more than expected to 5% in the 3 months to September. That's up from 4.8% over 3 months prior. The ONS said the figures pointed to a weakening of the labour market. BBC analysis shows that only 3 of England's 121 NHS hospital trusts are meeting the target to treat cancer patients within 62 days of an urgent referral. The government is expected to publish a new cancer strategy early next year. US senators have passed a measure to temporarily fund the federal government, ending the longest shutdown in history. 8 Democrats voted with Republicans to resume funding until the end of January. The legislation will need to be approved by the House of Representatives.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom. It is 27 minutes to 9 now. People living in Ukraine are facing a worsening situation as winter looms once again with no sign of respite from the war in frontline towns and cities. Despite several flurries of international diplomatic activity to try to end the conflict with Russia, things have gone quiet yet again, with Vladimir Putin not taking Donald Trump up on an invitation for a new bilateral meeting several weeks back. So let's look at the situation in areas of need. Aid agencies are still doing what they can. Christopher Lockyer is Secretary General of MSF International and currently in the Dnipro region of Ukraine. We will speak to him in just a few moments. So Shashank Joshi also joins as the defence editor at The Economist. Shashank, good morning. Shashank Joshi, good morning. Can you hear me?
Hello, good morning. Good morning to you.
Hi, thank you for joining us. We were talking there about the situation in Ukraine and that it really appears on the front pages and then tends to vanish again for a period of time. What is the situation for people in some of those areas?
Well, it depends where you look, but if you look at the front lines, the focus at the moment is on the town of Pokrovsk, which is in Donetsk province in the east, in the Donbass region. And that is where Russia has been focusing its efforts, its offensive efforts. And it looks to be on the cusp of taking Pokrovsk. It had hoped to do so a year ago. Ukraine has resisted for a long time, imposing very heavy casualties on the Russians. But it does look like Pokrovsk will fall. That would be the biggest win for Russia since 2023. It would show that Russia has the initiative on the battlefield. But it also shouldn't be exaggerated. When you hear about Pokrovsk, it's worth remembering this is a place with a pre-war population of 60,000. You know, I think that's roughly the same as something like Scarborough. And it really doesn't indicate any massive Russian momentum. When Pokrovsk eventually falls, it does not mean they are going to be able to sweep into other Ukrainian towns at all.
Shashank, thank you. Christopher Lockyer, as I mentioned, is also with us, Secretary General of MSF, who is in Dnipro at the moment. Christopher, in those areas, places that Shashank was talking about there, how are civilians coping? Because so much of the infrastructure just simply doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, well, that's right. And in fact, I'm in a displacement centre, in a centre for displaced people in Dnipro at the moment. And I've just come from speaking to a woman who's recently displaced from Pokrovsk. She was evacuated by train, and she's come here with her daughter and her granddaughter. And she was just telling me literally a few minutes ago about the desperate need that they have had for medication, the desperate situation at home. Her apartment had been destroyed, and she had no other option but to displace from Pokrovsk to Dnipro just literally a few weeks ago.
And in terms of the aid that is getting there, and we know that there have been deep cuts to foreign aid in various countries, what do you have to work with?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that, you know, the main weight of the humanitarian response has been borne by the Ukrainian authorities, the Ukrainian healthcare system. But the situation that we're really concerned about at the moment is that as we're entering the fourth winter since the escalation of this war, we're really seeing an intensification on attacks on infrastructure. We're seeing a reduction in terms of electricity provision. I'm at the moment sitting in a laundry room of this displacement centre because the power's been cut. It's the only place I can get light. This, of course, this dramatic impact on the energy infrastructure obviously impacts people's livelihoods, impacts their healthcare situation. But to your question, it also impacts the complexity of providing humanitarian assistance. So I was in two hospitals just the other day, and both of them were struggling with the energy supply, concerns about power surges, damaging medical equipment while they're supporting people. So it's a real, the infrastructure and the depletion of availability of electricity in particular is really impacting the healthcare and the humanitarian response in general.
How many organisations like yours are still working in those parts of Ukraine? Because it's obviously dangerous for people living there, which makes it dangerous for staff like yours. Is there a lack, frankly, of people to help?
Well, there's certainly a need for a scale-up of humanitarian assistance. It's an incredibly complex place to work. On one hand, we are working to try and support those who have direct trauma from the conflict, trying to work with them with physiotherapists to rehabilitate them, in many cases working in partnership with Ukrainian organizations to be able to facilitate their return back to society. But also the psychological impact of this war, yes, at the front lines where there's some extremely heavy and technically advanced drone warfare being used, but also some very heavy artillery. But across the whole of the country, the long range of some of the munitions that have been used means that the population has been terrorized thousands of kilometers away from the front line. So it's a massive project to be able to provide, on one hand, that acute services when people are receiving debilitating injuries, but also trying to provide psychosocial and mental health support throughout the whole of the country. We're doing a very small amount in that, but there's a need for joining up the dots for a whole network of health response across the whole country.
Christopher Lockyer, Secretary General of MSF International, thank you for joining us. Thanks to Shashank Joshi, Defence Editor at The Economist.
It is 21 minutes to nine. It's more than half a century since kidnappers planned to seize Rupert Murdoch's then wife Anna and demand £1 million in ransom. By mistake, they seized and then murdered the wife of Murdoch's deputy, Muriel McKay. Her body was never found, but she has now finally been officially declared dead. The ruling by a High Court judge will allow her family to pursue a new search for her remains in the garden of an East London tailor's shop where the notorious gangsters, the Cray twins, had their suits made. The story was the subject of a BBC podcast, Worse Than Murder, hosted by Jane McSorley.
The abduction of Muriel McKay led to the biggest manhunt of its day, but it was all in vain.
the family never saw Muriel again.
It was a very happy house before this awful thing happened.
By the end of the investigation, the lead detective on the case said that what the Mackays had been through was worse than murder.
What the Mackays had been through? Well, we're joined by one of them, indeed the son of Muriel Mackay. Ian joins us on the line. He's now living in Australia. Good morning to you. What was this moment like when you heard that it had been declared that your mother was officially deemed to be dead?
Well, obviously it's a little bit late in the day. I mean, she would have been 110 at this stage. So, it just basically, the decision by the High Court now allows us to proceed with what we believe, what I believe, and we believe generally, is the hottest lead that we've had in the entire investigation, without a doubt.
And the lead was because you, the family, had some contact with one of the kidnappers.
Well, yes, that was the start of it. We actually went to Trinidad, and we actually found out that the murderer, I'll call him murderer because that's what he was sentenced for, and who claimed that he had buried my mother in the garden at pasture at Brooks Farm. It's no doubt he actually confessed to this and put it in writing, but we believe that the body was later moved. In fact, we're very certain the body was moved, and his brother Arthur always claimed that we would never ever find the body. And now this gives us an opportunity to deal with this new evidence, which we really believe is a very hot lead.
So you think there's a real chance that, first of all, your mother's body was moved and that the remains will still be there and locatable?
Yes, that's quite correct. What happened was there was a tailor at 447 Bethnal Green Road who actually, Arthur Hussain, used to supply his tailoring expertise and finish off trousers and suits and things. And he used to work as what they call an outworker. And the tailor actually who ran the shop, a man called Percy Chaplin, on his deathbed only 2 years ago, basically confessed via his family that he believed that the body was buried behind the shop at Bethnal Green Road.
Has this search, Ian, has this search taken over large parts of your adult life?
Yes, it has. I mean, obviously, I'm 83 now, and I'm keen to have a final answer on this. But we've been aided very much by my nephew, Mark Dyer, who's been our inspiration for keeping this going. And
capture for people why, Ian, this awful, terrible tragedy in your family's life, the murder of your mother, the murder you then discover accidentally. Why, for so many decades, you're now in your 80s, have you needed to find her remains?
Well, we feel that we owe it to her. It's we feel, you know, completely, cheated by the fact that we were never able to help her at the time. And I have no doubt, having spent the last couple of months in great detail going through this case and through every piece of information that was published to find out what the truth really is. And then when Hayley Frey came forward, who was the daughter of Percy Chaplin, the tailor at Bethnal Green Road, she tried to contact us twice. The first time the police spoke to her and they dismissed what she had as being inconsequential. And they didn't advise us at the time. And then later on, we made a financial offer and brought three potential hot leads forward.
Yes,
and
which you're now pursuing. Ian, we've got to leave it there, I'm afraid. But thank you so much for telling us about your search. The
podcast, by the way, Worse Than Murder, is on what's called BBC Intrigue on BBC Sounds. I'm just checking now. You can still listen to it there. It is an extraordinary story as well as an extraordinary tragedy in Mackay in Australia. Thank you for telling us about it, and we do wish you luck with that search.
Later this morning on Radio 4, All in the Mind is looking at the mental health impact of living in asylum hotels. And Claudia Hammond hears from one asylum seeker who spent more than a year living in an asylum hotel in London, talking about the impact that it had on them. So that's on the way later this morning. You'll find it 9:30.
So there is two debates, really, about the future of the BBC. One is about impartiality, which we discussed at some length yesterday. The other is about the nature of the BBC itself. It doesn't have a right to exist. Indeed, that is built into the law of the land, because every 10 years there is the need for a new, what's called Royal Charter, to maintain the BBC and maintain or perhaps replace the licence fee. So let's turn to that argument about whether public service broadcasting is needed, whether the BBC is needed, and could it exist in a much smaller form, perhaps, doing rather less and doing it better. We can get the thoughts now of Stephen Lambert, Chief Executive of Studio Lambert, who can't do anything better because his company makes The Traitors. It is yet another reality television hit for the Lambert Empire. Morning and congratulations to you, Stephen.
Thank you, Nick.
I'll bring in Damien Collins as well, a former Conservative culture minister who's considered these. And perhaps start with you, Damien. Do you think, and you know the debate within the House of Commons well, that the argument will now shift to making the BBC smaller and getting it to do less?
Well, morning, Nick. I think it's really a question about, at the moment, there's a matter of trust between the licence fee payers and the BBC.
I tell you what, Jim, your line's not great. I'm going to go to Stephen and see if we can improve your line. Stephen, you've warned against it, haven't you? You've warned against the idea that the BBC should shrink.
I have, and I don't think that that's a good idea for the BBC. I mean, its legitimacy in terms of being able to receive the licence fee, the compulsory payment by anybody with a television set, it depends on it providing a service for all the country. And that means the BBC has to do as much as it does.
But the licence fee itself doesn't have to keep on existing. And indeed, as you know, a growing number of people are simply refusing to pay it. And I clearly don't recommend this because it would be against the law. But there will be people who look at what's happened recently and say, well, I'm definitely not paying.
Well, that's true. And the trouble is that if you take the licence fee away, the BBC doesn't have many routes for becoming a funded organisation. It either takes on advertising, which divides the advertising pot in a way that is it would be damaging to all commercial television, or it becomes a subscription service like Netflix. Now, it will be a very small service compared to Netflix. Netflix draws its money from across the world. A BBC subscription service, if you turn the iPlayer into a subscription-only service, it wouldn't have anything like the income that it currently receives.
Is it too crude, Stephen, to say no licence fee, no traitors?
Well, the traitors is, funnily enough, probably what you would spend your money on if the BBC just was a subscription service.
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest problem the BBC faces, I think, is the fact that its consumption is still so old. You know, most people watching BBC television are over 60. Even the iPlayer struggles to get the young audience.
Yeah. Let's bring Damien Collins back. I think we've got a better line for you now, Mr. Collins. You were beginning to say you thought there was a choice.
Yeah, I think there's a choice for the BBC about...
I'm really sorry, that line's not working at all, is it? So we'll stay with you, Stephen. I mean, politicians have got a legitimate case to say, haven't they? Well, look, this is a compulsory tax. It's quite a large sum of money. And in an era in which we can get more and more, not just news, but entertainment, either for free or we can make a choice to pay rather than being obliged to pay, why on earth are we forced to pay?
Well, it comes down really to the BBC News. I think that in a democracy, the importance of news, an impartial news service, is just so important. And that is why what's happened is so problematic for the BBC. Anything that jeopardises that belief in the trust that we have in BBC News is something that undermines the justification for the licence fee.
Third time lucky with Mr. Collins. Damien, give it another go. What's the choice you want to tell us about?
Well, I think just following what you've just been talking about, it's about the relationship between the BBC and the licence fees. The biggest challenge the BBC faces today is whether more people will decline to pay the licence fee. Can you afford, therefore, to run the BBC in the way it's been run in the past with the breadth of services? It's very unlikely there's going to be political support for a big increase in the licence fee. And I think whilst commercial revenues can be grown in a number of different ways, that's not going to be enough. So that's the challenge the BBC faces. And at the heart of that is retaining the trust of the people that pay for it.
Just one last one, if I could, with Mr. Collins to you, which is, forgive me saying this, but I think I made a film about this in 1986 when I joined the BBC. Everyone says the licence fee probably needs replacing sometime, but I've never met anybody who actually has the solution to replace it, other than a new household tax, which I'm going to predict that no chancellor will bring in.
Well, that is true. The alternatives all seem a lot worse. The challenge, the difference between now and 1986 is the dominant central position of the big tech platforms. You know, so the increasing commercial power they have, the pull of audiences they have. YouTube is already now the biggest commercial distributor of television in this country. That power is only going to grow. And so in the old days, the concern was, is the BBC with a license fee too dominant in the media market? In the future, it's going to be, is it too small to compete? And is there a limit to what people are prepared to pay for it?
Yeah. Proof once again that it's easy to ask questions. That's what we do every day. It's quite hard to answer them, isn't it? But thank you for trying and persisting with the line. Damien Collins, former Conservative Culture Minister, Stephen Lambert of Studio Lambert, which makes the traitor. Would have liked to have asked him more about who's on the next series, but I don't imagine he would have told us.
Well, you never know. You might get a call yourself. Wait and see.
Oh, no.
Ruling yourself out now, are you? Yeah, get in early. It's
my agent is not sitting by her phone.
It's 9 minutes to nine now. Let's end the programme with something really good.
I want to be 14 again. Tattoo myself with a fountain pen. Pretend to like the taste of rum and coke. Chuck my school hat in a bush. Spit on my mascara brush by Consulate. And teach myself to smoke.
Yeah, Victoria Wood always lifts the spirits, doesn't she? That was 14 again, from 1983, from Lucky Bag. Now, the reason that we are playing you that is there's a theatre in the Lake District that Victoria Wood was a patron and trustee of, which is now going to be renamed in her honour, and a musical, including that song, is going to be staged there. Charlotte Scott joins us, theatre owner and director, and Tom McRae as well, who is the writer of that musical. Morning, both.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Charlotte, you first met Victoria Wood, I think, in about 1978, didn't you? You and she knew each other for a long time.
That's right. It was a long association. We met at Crucible Theatre, where she was doing some... She did a play called Talent, which people may have heard, and then Good Fun. And then we both realised she lived in Morecambe, and then later on we were in the Lakes and she was there. So we kept our friendship going. She became phenomenally successful. And then we then opened the Old Laundry in 1991, and she was there with us. So, you know, became a trustee of the theatre, did benefits for us, and we did two productions. We did Talent again and Housewife 49. So a sort of long friendship and working collaboration.
Yeah. And why did you decide to rename it now, the Victoria Wood Theatre, for her?
Well, the theatre had been open sort of 30-odd years. Victoria, amazingly, has been dead 10 years. And we were looking at sort of how we keep the theatre fresh and alive, and also keeping Victoria's legacy, which is very important to us. And, of course, it all became very, very obvious that, yes, we should become the Victoria Wood Theatre.
And Tom, as we were saying, you have written this particular musical, which is no mean feat because her songs are absolutely fabulous. And I can imagine any musical containing them will be brilliant. But actually trying to string them into a narrative, how did you manage that?
Well, I started by dividing the songs that I sort of had access to into themes and into categories. And there was kind of four, which was loss, childhood, broken relationships, and then the very specific character songs, like famously the Ballad of Barry and Frieda, with so much detail that you had to put them in quite a specific place in a story. And then I figured a story out. There's a very sad song called Baby in a Little Bit, which initially I thought, well, what do I do with this? It's the opposite of funny, it's tragic. But figuring out how to place that unlocked the whole story. And so what we have is something that's really quite epic, actually. It is about two women and their friendship, but it's not a cozy evening around the piano singing about, you know, wagon wheels and the menopause, although of course there's a bit of that. It's quite an epic adventure for them. It's a big journey. It's an emotional roller coaster. And at the heart of it is Vic's wonderful songs.
And she was so clever, wasn't she, in the way that she took the mundane and the ordinary, but ultimately the relatable. I mean, you talked about the Ballad of Barry and Frieda, which is an absolute classic and so simple, but you know, people loved it and still do.
Yeah, I think the way that she could take something ordinary and make it magnificent. I mean, something, it was before this, I wrote Everybody's Talking About Jamie, which was my first musical. And that was kind of the same idea, was it's just a boy and his mum, but you make it epic by filling it with music and joy and heartbreak and then having a very happy ending. And spoilers, this does have a very happy ending, but it takes you a while to get there. And it's guided by the grit and the sadness that Victoria wrote about as well. But taking just ordinary life and celebrating it, it's something that I think is really important and joyous. And she was the master of it.
Yeah. And I imagine having, you know, when that's actually playing, Charlotte, in the Victoria Wood Theatre, that'll be a really special moment for you, but for everybody who knew her.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is amazing for us that it's happening. It's live theatre, it's in Cumbria, but it's a bigger thing than that. And yes, for everyone who knew her and has followed her and everything, yes, it's an amazing moment.
And I suppose for you as well, Tom, you did write what I think ended up being the last thing that she was in, didn't you?
Yes, I mean, not that any of us would have known it, but it was the last show that I wrote in the UK before I moved to LA. And so I got to know Vic a little bit, and she was really lovely, and I was a huge, huge fan. And getting to kind of work on this with her, because, you know, she's my collaborator, albeit it's a bit one-sided now, but I really feel the presence of her, because even if you never met her, and I only knew her a little bit, I think she's one of those people that the nation feels that they know, and we still want to kind of hold her to our hearts. So getting to celebrate her like this, it's like welcoming an old friend kind of back into your living room, or going to sit in her living room and have a cup of tea. And like I say, we go on a journey. It's got a big old story. But at the end of it, you know, Vic sort of gives you a hug and sends you on your way with the best song she wrote, which is Barry and Frieda, which, you know, we do end the show with. And yeah. So you're going to go home dancing and laughing.
And you know, it's absolutely fitting, Tom, that this is happening in the Lakes at this particular theatre. But I know there'll be people listening to this, and some who will travel and see it, but some who will say, what about a tour? Is it going to go anybody else? Do you think it'll travel, Tom?
I really hope it will. But at the moment, we only have our 3 and a bit weeks in the Lakes. So if you really want to see it, don't wait. Book your tickets. I really hope it will go everywhere, because I think it's such a big universal story. And not everyone, you know, people under the age of 30 maybe don't know Victoria anymore. But we had a few of those in our workshop performance last week. And they all love the story and the songs, which they were discovering for the first time. So it's not just for the Victoria Wood fans. It is for anyone who wants to have a good night out.
Yeah, it sounds great. Thank you both. Tom McRae, who's written 14 Again, and Charlotte Scott from the Victoria Wood Theatre.
Just before we go, there's a chance to take a look at those unemployment figures that came in this morning. Another sign of some difficulty in the economy. Sean's been looking at them for us. What do they tell us, Sean?
Yes, so unemployment rate rising to 5%. That's a jump from 4.8% that we'd have been talking about a month ago. This is in the three-month period to September, and he's a little higher than many experts, economists expected as well. Alongside that, because there's been some question marks around the labour force survey that the Office for National Statistics put together. But when we look at payroll data as well, the ONS saying that falling payrolls show a weakening in the jobs market. Average wage growth slowing, which means expectations of a rate cut by the Bank of England next month have gone up a little bit. You can see that this morning by looking at the bond market, as we so often do at the moment, and the interest rate on the 10-year bond, the government borrowing over a 10-year period, has fallen a little bit on the back of that, amongst other things. So there'll be a bit of a debate now about what it is Rachel Reeves will do in
the
budget.
What does it mean for the budget?
Yeah, well, quite, because Rachel Reeves will see that the jobs market is weakening. And as we heard this morning, some evidence showing that that's because of some decisions she made a year ago. Chuck into the mix the advent of AI and companies making changes on that, global tariffs impacting the ability to trade at certain points this year. It's a bit bit murky to try and decide exactly what it is. But when you get a number of 5%, a figure of unemployment rate that we haven't seen since the pandemic, end of 2020 into 2021, it's not a headline that Rachel Reeves is going to be wanting to see this morning.
2 weeks tomorrow, the budget. Sean, thank you very much indeed. Big decisions that she's big